Calling to order the September 29, 2016 meeting, joint meeting of the Kirkland Planning Commission and the Houghton Community Council. Can I have the roll call, please?
Carter Bagg, Colleen Cullen.
Here.
Eric Law Liberty.
Here.
Mike Miller.
Here.
Glenn Peterson.
Here.
Matthew Pruitt.
Here.
Sandeep Singal.
Here.
Kelly Curtis.
Here.
Brian Gothram.
Here.
Bill Goggins. John Kapler.
Here.
Betsy Pringle.
Here.
Elsie Weber.
Here.
Rick Whitney.
Here.
We have two items on our agenda tonight. The first is a joint public hearing on amendments to the critical areas ordinance. The second is a study session on amendments on the low impact development section of the city code. That is it for tonight. Before we get to the joint public hearing, I understand that there's at least one individual here to give comment on something not otherwise on our agenda tonight. If there's anyone else in the audience who has comments on something outside of the critical areas ordinance or the low impact development study session, there's a sign-in sheet to the front. If you have comments on those specific issues, there are also two other sign-in sheets for those. I just ask you to sign up ahead of time. So, Mr. Contreras, you want to go first? Did anyone else sign in for comment on non-agenda items? No. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good evening, joint, all of you. Good to see you. I'm going to speak on behalf of the Save Our Trail / No SD3 / Smarter Transit group. We've established a coalition. You'll probably recall our Save Our Trail work, which didn't really work all that well. And we've teamed up with a bunch of Seattle folks that are talking about smarter transit. So I want to make clear to you, we're not here against transit. We're here for the right kind of transit, which we think SD3 for $54 billion forever is not the answer. So thank you. I know that planning can't take a position. I'm hoping individually you'll decide and let it be known what you want to do. I am asking the Houghton Community Council to step forward and take a vote. Probably not tonight, but I'll come to your October meeting if you can get it on the agenda, or if I'm welcome to be there to talk about that issue. You previously took a position on it, and for that I thank you. Very important to us. I want to make clear that if you vote or the voters support Sound Transit 3, you will have rail on the trail. Because Claudia Balducci, late in the game, if you recall, put in a Wilburton to South Kirkland Park and Ride spur, which is rail. Guess what? That's the beginning of rail across the trail all the way up to Woodinville. And that's what's going to happen if you approve this, because Sound Transit has the easement. There's nothing to prevent them doing it if they choose to do it, other than potentially things that you folks might have a say-so in. But that's kind of iffy. Sound Transit 3 does nothing for Kirkland. I don't know if you looked at it. It does things for two cities on the east side, Redmond and Issaquah. Redmond, John Marchione is on the Sound Transit board. Butler, Issaquah mayor, is an executive committee on the Sound Transit board. And we're going to have rail from Bellevue to Issaquah. You have to really think about that. We're spending a couple billion bucks for potentially 5,000 riders 25 years from now. That just speaks to part of the problem that we have with Sound Transit. It's very much a good old boy system or good old woman system, depending on your bent. And I think the worst thing of all, it's a blank check, because if you approve Sound Transit 3, they can charge you that money forever, as long as Sound Transit Board chooses to do so. And did you know they don't have to do the project you're seeing in the media today? They can do anything they want to do once you say yes. So I think you have to really beware. Look on nosd3.org website if you want to know what the effect will be on you personally. We have a tax calculator. The average Kirkland family will spend over $1,000 a year forever if this thing goes through. That's a lot of money for nothing for Kirkland. And as I mentioned earlier, there's no legal obligation that the projects have to be done as proposed. Sound Transit can do whatever it chooses to do. 25 years from now, in case you're wondering about the benefit to traffic, 1% of total traffic or transit will be because of this. So you're waiting 25 years, spending about $25,000 to $30,000 each individual family in Kirkland for a 1% improvement in the long run. We're saying, let's go do bus rapid transit right now, sooner, way sooner than later, on existing roadways. I've asked the clerk for you to hand out a couple pages for you that you've got in front of you. One explains who we are, and then really gives you the highlights of what we believe. And I just want to make clear, people misunderstand us and think, oh, we're against transit. Absolutely not against transit. What we're for is smarter transit. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, sir.
Is there anyone else who'd like to give? Oh, thank you. I've been prompted. I let the record reflect that Bill Goggins has arrived just after 7:02 maybe. Is there anyone else in the audience tonight who would like to give public comment on an item not on our agenda tonight? Okay, in that case, we will move to the joint public hearing on the amendments to the critical areas ordinances. We have a staff presentation tonight. Okay, great. We'll take public comment after following the staff presentation.
Good evening. I'm Joan Lieberman-Brill with City of Kirkland Planning Department, and we're going to be looking at the Chapter 90 Critical Areas Update. This is the public hearing to review the proposed ordinance and take public comment. And then hopefully you will be able to deliberate and make a recommendation this evening to the Planning Commission, in the case of the Houghton Community Council, and for the Planning Commission's recommendation to the City Council. The agenda, again, I'm going to be making a presentation. We're going to open the, following that, we'll open up the hearing to a public comment, and then that will be closed, and then questions and discussions by the Planning Commission and the Houghton Community Council will follow, and then the Houghton Community Council will deliberate and make a recommendation, and following that, the Planning Commission will deliberate and make a recommendation. Here's a summary of what we've done so far. We've had 10 public meetings. We've held those between January and July of 2016. We've had 3 open houses, one preceded tonight's meeting. We've worked closely with the Department of Ecology and other agencies and the Puget Sound Energy Company. We've mailed out notice, had a web page, and a listserv. We'd like to go over new code amendments since the last study session that we had in July. We'd like to review the comments from the state agencies and the Muckleshoot Tribe. We'd like to summarize the final draft, Chapter 90, and then go over the next steps. So in terms of code amendments since the last study session, we realized that one provision that is in the existing Chapter 90 code had not been brought forward into the revision. And this is a requirement to restore degraded wetlands or streams, the actual critical area, rather than just the buffers. And so we brought this forward into this draft iteration, the final iteration, and we've added the provision that this wetland or stream that is degraded would have to be enhanced if the proposed development is greater than 1,000 square feet. So similarly to how we treat buffer requirements, if the proposal is greater than 1,000 square feet of new footprint, we would require the full buffer to be enhanced if it is degraded. So we use the same threshold for this. The other code amendments that have been brought forward with this draft, this final draft, are numerous revisions to other chapters in the zoning code, including new definitions that are required for this critical area update. We've also amended chapters of the municipal code, including our subdivision ordinance. And there are things like replacing words like sensitive areas with critical area, just bringing the vocabulary up to date and making things internally consistent. And finally, we just started talking about the vegetative buffer at a ratio of 1:1 for additions of less than 1,000 square feet. This is something that you all have reviewed in previous study sessions. Well, we got to thinking about when a buffer that is fully functioning is encroached upon, that there ought to be also an additional requirement that for every tree, significant tree that is removed, that there would be a replacement of those significant trees by two. So it would be 2:1 replacement. And then if a tree that's at least 24 inches in diameter is removed, that three trees would be required for replacement. So that's an additional standard that we thought about after we had previously shown you a draft. Regarding comments from the Department of Fish and Wildlife, this is in your packet as well. They were complimentary of the new code, but they did question why we require a structure setback of 10 feet and not 15 feet. As you may recall, some jurisdictions require a 15-foot structure setback. Others require a 10-foot structure setback. It's been working well for us. We feel that it is a sufficient width, and are going to recommend that it stays 10 feet. Regarding comments from the Department of Ecology, the wildlife corridor should be provided through a wetland buffer to adjacent areas, and we thought that this was a good comment. We did add this requirement in the fish and wildlife habitat section if a critical areas report and a management plan deem that this would be an appropriate mitigation measure. So we added that to that section. And then they also had the comment that they would like to withhold financial security until other agencies approve the release of it and of their own. And we, the city has never done business like that. We release our own securities and do not hold up in a security just because another agency has an interest in doing so. They have our communication with them is not always as good as it could be. There might be lag time, and we really feel that it's not our responsibility to try to administer their securities. Comments from the Muckleshoot tribe, they had recommended that rather than the stream typing that we've proposed in our draft, that another type be utilized that better addresses fish barriers. Well, we never received the same recommendation from the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We also acknowledge that in our shoreline management program, we use the same stream typing as we're proposing in this draft, and we think that is appropriate for consistencies. Also, other jurisdictions are using the stream typing that we are proposing in our Chapter 90. And we do recognize that if the State Department of Fish and Wildlife do adopt the new stream typing, that it would be appropriate to again visit this and maybe change it at that time. But for now, we're recommending that we stay the course. They also, the Muckleshoot tribe also commented that they would recommend that we address shading of streams to prevent water temperature rising. And we thought this was appropriate, and we added a provision for vegetating a buffer so that there is shading plants and trees placed near the edge of a stream. Moving on to the key regulations in Chapter 90, to summarize, we allow four different types of permits. One is an exemption. Those are for activities and improvements that have very little impact or no impact to the buffer. And those are allowed outright. And there's a list of them in your Chapter 90. And they have addressed some of the suggested exemptions that either board has commented upon over the course of this study. The permitted activities and improvements, they have minor impacts to the buffer. They are subject to a critical area report, mitigation sequencing. They require planning official approval. And then we have those ones are permitted outright if they meet certain standards and they go through that report and the sequencing. Then we have exceptions for public agencies and public utilities. This is a situation where, let's say, a public agency or public utility can't stay in the outer 25% of the buffer for their improvement, and they must go further into the buffer to make the utility line work or what have you. And so they could propose an exception to the rules. And the criteria that would be needed to be met is that strict application of the regulations of the chapter would unreasonably restrict or prohibit the ability to provide services to the public. That's one of the major criteria that would have to be met. So it's a way for that meets the public good, something that rises above and needs to occur to serve a public purpose. Then we have programmatic permits. This is new. This is a permit that would be for a public agency or a public utility for an activity that's repetitive or as part of a maintenance or other program. It has similar impacts. It's suitable for standard conditions, and it's a way to expedite and streamline the administration of our codes. We see this as a good remedy for especially our Public Works Department, for example, who has a lot of ongoing maintenance of culverts, let's say. And if we could get a good program going, it would be better for the city to go that route. The next slide summarizes what we've done with our wetland buffer width standards. This is based on best available science and guidance from the Department of Ecology. Our current wetland buffers widths are shown in the upper left. We have three wetland types under the current wetland scheme. Our wetlands that are being proposed, our wetland rating system has four classifications of wetlands, and that is more similar to how we currently administer our Shoreline Master Program. And you can see that buffer width requirements in the lower left-hand chart, the Shoreline Master Program shoreline buffer widths. And the new wetland buffer standards range from 40 feet wide for the lower functioning buffers and wetland classifications to up to 225 feet wide buffers for the highest functioning wetlands. And these widths assume that the buffer is well vegetative with the native plants and does not contain fill or lawn or invasives. Regarding the stream buffer width standards, this slide shows the comparison of the current stream buffers upper left based on three classifications of streams, and we at this point have primary and secondary basins. Those will go away. And we will be typing our streams more, well, very similarly to how we type those in the shoreline jurisdiction. And there's the fish bearing stream, for they're called Fs. There's the NPs, no fish, and they're year-round streams. And then we have the NS, the no fish. They're seasonal. And so you can see that the width of the fish-bearing streams are 100 feet now for the buffer. But the fish-bearing streams in the shoreline jurisdiction are 115 feet. So it's a little less than what is in the shoreline jurisdiction for the F stream, but it's, and it's a little less of a width for the NS as is in the shoreline jurisdiction. But we felt it was a mid-range, that it was met many of the our neighboring jurisdictions' buffer widths for streams. And again, this assumes that the buffer will be well vegetated and not contain invasives or fill or lawn. We've added fish wildlife habitat conservation areas to what is regulated in our critical areas ordinance. These are federally endangered, threatened, and sensitive species and state priority species. What is new about this is that a habitat management report has to be provided for development that's proposed in an area that has these species, and that would be determined with the wetland report that's done by a qualified professional. And then the components of the management plan could include seasonal restrictions on construction. It may address buffer widths that are a little different than what we have in our wetland requirements, depending on if they address the sensitivity of the habitat of the wildlife that's being protected, and could include restrictions on access into that habitat area. We allow buffer averaging under this critical area provisions for both wetlands and stream buffers. However, it used to be that we would allow a reduction of a third, and now it's a quarter of the width. And that's a change. We will be requiring a vegetative buffer standard. We've spoken about this in the past. It includes multi-story canopy of forest canopy, shrubs, and ground cover. It requires a certain variety of native species for diversity, and it requires removal of lawn. It requires it allows alternative plans for unique circumstances based on criteria if it meets the intent of the vegetative standard. We will continue to require a building setback from the edge of a wetland buffer or a stream buffer of 10 feet, like we said before, but we are being more flexible about what can be located within that 10 feet. The function of a setback to a wetland or stream buffer, that 10 feet is an area in which you can install the primary improvements that are in the uplands. It's where you can do activities associated with those improvements in the uplands, and you can repair and maintain those improvements that are in the uplands, or it's to enable the use of that area if it doesn't impact the buffer itself, the critical area buffer itself. So there's a list of improvements that we are proposing to allow within that area. and they can be as far into the setback as up to 1 foot within the edge of that setback, that 10-foot area. Regarding nonconformances under the current Chapter 90, it's more restrictive. The current nonconforming rules, well, existing legally installed improvements are grandfathered. You can maintain and repair those improvements, but you cannot replace them. For casualties like due to fire, if it's 50% or less of valuation, you can reconstruct. But for greater than 50% valuation, the new structure has to be brought into conformance. And expansion of a nonconformance is not allowed. Again, this is our current code. Now, as a comparison, the proposed rules would, similarly to the old, allow nonconformances to be grandfathered. We would also allow maintenance and repair of those improvements that are grandfathered. We would allow replacement of the same footprint and the same size. And for single family casualties, they could do a total reconstruction. There's no more 50% or less cutoff. For other uses, commercial, industrial, or so on, if the damage is more than 50%, then the nonconformance has to be brought into conformance. And then another new provision is that we can expand a nonconformance, and we'll talk about that in a moment. It's based on a gradation from 250 square feet to 1,000 square feet, depending on where it is, where the proposed expansion is on the subject property. So here we get into more specifics about the expansion of nonconforming structures. In this graphic, you have a home in a critical area buffer, the blue. It's an existing nonconforming house. And if a person were to propose an expansion, they could do so if it's in the rear of the house, away from the buffer, towards the buffer setback. They could have an expansion of 1,000 square feet. And so the number one with the circle around it is where that is represented, that 1,000 square feet. If, on the other hand, they wanted to expand towards the side of the structure, they could do a 500 square foot cap on the expansion of the footprint. And then if they wanted to go towards the critical area, they could go up to 250 square foot with their footprint, a new expanded footprint. Now, this also allows the building up of, you know, another story above that expanded footprint. So it's doubling the square footage from 250 to, say, 500 square feet if you go forward of the structure towards the wetland. Or towards the side, it would be 1,000 square feet if you went up a second story, or, you know, we could extrapolate from there. For mitigation, if it's 1,000 square feet or less, it's a 1-to-1 ratio. 1 square foot of area replaced with one square foot of expansion would require a 1 square foot of mitigation, a new buffer area. It's a 1-to-1. So instead of having to enhance the whole wetland buffer like we do for proposals that are over 1,000 square feet, you would only have to do 1-to-1. And if, like we talked about before, there are trees that are removed as a result of the expansion, we would require replacement with 2 trees for every 1 that are removed. Or if it's a tree that's greater than 24 inches in diameter, we would require 3 replacement trees for the one that was removed. And that's to provide an incentive for people not to go and try to remove trees in the critical area buffer. A couple of important notes: that you can't reduce the buffer more than 60% of the original width, and expansion into the critical area itself is not permitted, and this is only a one-time expansion. So if you ask for a 500-square-foot expansion, that's it. That's as much encroachment into the expansion into the of the nonconformance that you can ask for.
A question. Sorry to derail you there, but on that one-time expansion, that's no matter. Maybe I didn't follow. That's no matter which way it's expanded. If you're in the buffer, okay.
Yes.
To follow up on that, is it transferable? So let's say a current owner expands and sells the house, and there's a new owner 5 years from now.
Yeah, he's stuck.
It's stuck.
Yeah.
Okay, and it would be in the title, or how would they know?
I'm not sure. Have we thought about that? How it would be recorded, possibly in our. We have a electronic permit system, and there might be a note on the parcel.
So it would be disclosed when they buy the property.
Well, theoretically, it should be disclosed. Whether they do it or not, we can't govern that. Yeah. But we can.
If it's not untitled, it won't be disclosed.
What's that, John?
If it's not untitled, I doubt
right.
It'll be
yeah.
disclosed.
But it would be in any partial data system we have, so they can track it that way.
There wouldn't be an easement or anything like that.
Well, we could create a covenant. Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. Staff wants to clarify that someone could propose 1,000 square feet on the backside, a 250 and a 500. They just can't come back a year or two later, and they've already done a 500 expansion. They want to go in and do another 500. So
right.
that someone could use each one of those provisions, 1,000, 500, and 250. We just don't want someone come back 2 years later and say, I want to do another 250.
Further clarification: they can do all three of those all those options at different
Correct.
Times, or do they have to do it at?
I think they can do it all at once. I mean,
or they can come back. You know, they can do the 1,000, and then 2 years later, they can come back and do it in the other direction.
Correct.
Okay.
We just don't want multiples of all
right,
those, because then you're going beyond
sure.
what the original intent was, to allow everybody to have a one time on each one of those.
But it's called an order of preference here.
We discussed that earlier in the year, but
yeah.
we decided to move away from it, because if someone has a kitchen and they want a larger kitchen, it's in the 250 area, that's really where they're going to enlarge. We're just saying that they could do all three at once, or they could do one of those over each year. But if you think about how much that could be, that would be, 1,250. No, it's just a lot of square footage, because remember, it's a footprint, but it does include a second floor. So 1,000 could easily be a 2,000-foot addition.
I have two more follow-up questions. Number one, is there any restrictions in going down, like a basement that they would dig out close to a critical area?
It's really, we're looking at the impact of a footprint. And
okay.
so your second, that going down below would be a footprint, unless it was totally subterranean. But you're still disturbing. Is that what you're thinking?
Instead of having a slab and going, level one, level two, they could dig down and then have three levels.
Yes, they could do that too. Yes.
Okay.
Because that's what I'm saying. You could even actually have 3,000 square feet, where they, let's say they have a flat roof.
I didn't know if there'd be restrictions because of the critical area. Because of the groundwater or the subterranean
I don't know.
Issues.
No,
Sarah? No.
That would be the footprint.
Okay.
It's just the footprint.
My second question, it's kind of detail-oriented, I guess, but the replacement ratio of 1:1 or 1:1, I wrote it down here, if it's greater than 24 inches, higher ratio, does it have to be the same species of tree? Is there any specific on
no.
that? Because some trees are a lot more expensive to replace.
And that's like that 24-inch, that's really like a landmark tree, a very large tree. So that's why, and usually when they replant them, they're not very large trees. They're just what you would get at a local nursery. So that's why you want the 2-to-1 replacement or the 3-to-1. So no, they can, we would probably look at the our wetland standard, the vegetative standard, just to make sure we have some diversity. You know, probably would not prefer if they plant all the same three if they don't have much else on their site. But other than that, if they remove a hemlock, I don't think it has to be a hemlock. They can choose what they want.
Can I follow up on that? Because if you've got one large tree and you take that out, but three trees are going to eventually grow up to take, you know, a lot more space. And what if that just seems kind of like there's not room for it? It's going to provide 3 times as much shade in your yard or something like that. I mean, what exactly is the point? Is it to get what benefit to the buffer are we really trying to achieve? And does three trees necessarily achieve that buffer, or is there something else that might, because three trees can, that takes up a lot of room when they're fully grown, and it really would change maybe your yard.
It has to do with the ecological function, the habitat function. Keep in mind that these homeowners do not have to put in the entire buffer. Most people then would have to vegetate the whole buffer. So you're going to have more than three trees if you just have a fully functioning buffer. And so most of these people will not have that. So the idea is that a large landmark tree serves a lot for wildlife habitat. And so if you put in three trees, it's a tremendous loss until those trees get larger. I mean, these trees you're talking are very old trees. Right. So it's going to take a long time for when, you know, your standard trees you'd put in. So basically it's just to replace the habitat function of those. And we probably won't have very many of those. We don't have too many, you know, they're more unique situation. But there's just the loss of those over the life of that landmark tree. You just need to have
I understand the value. I'm just trying to be practical. If it's on somebody's property and three, you know, in 20 years, three trees are going to have a very different impact than.
There's a lot of choice about what you replant. So, I mean, in theory, you could take down a big Doug fir or cedar and plant something that's going to fit. And I don't think we would encourage somebody to plant on a small lot to plant three big new cedars that are going to consume the house. You probably want to pick something that's right for the space.
And I understand that, but I mean, then those three trees, let's say it's three fruit trees or something, I mean, they are not going to have the same function as that cedar did or as that hemlock did.
No.
So it's...
I think that's why, well, I mean, there are two reasons to pick a higher number of trees than the one that's taken down. One is that you take a 25-inch Doug fir tree down, you know, one new 2-inch tree isn't really going to compensate for that. Maybe over time by having more, you can get closer to that kind of compensation.
I understand. It just feels...
I think Sarah had something to say here, too.
Well, I just wanted to mention the fruit trees. So it does, the code does specify that they would need to be native trees. So
native trees,
yeah.
Okay, I think we have just a few slides left in the presentation.
Yeah. So this is next steps, and this is to remind you that in November we have a city council study session, and then in December we will go to the city council for the adopting ordinance. In January, back to the Houghton Community Council for their final action by resolution. And then we are waiting until February 2017 to have the ordinance be effective. And we have to do a lot of follow-up and training of staff and getting the word out. So do you have further questions or comments? And then we will...
Okay, great. We'll take public comment then. And we have received a lot of public comment already. Both at our study sessions and in writing before this meeting. Everyone's read all of that, and we've considered all of that.
Yes. You get to ask your questions after public comment then?
Yeah, okay. I think...
That's fine.
I think we'll do it that way. Okay, so I know a few people have walked in recently. I have the sign-in sheets. If you didn't have a chance to sign in before they were handed up to me, you'll still have the opportunity to give public comment. I'll just ask for that after we have those who've already signed in. So first tonight, we have Brent Carson. Before Mr. Carson starts, just a reminder, we limit comment to 3 minutes. There's a green light, yellow light, red light. That's it.
Good evening, members of the Planning Commission and Houghton Community Council. My name is Brent Carson. I'm a land use and environmental attorney, been doing this for about 30 years now. A lot of my practice is representing both public and private clients on wetland compliance issues. And so I thought I would take this opportunity to come and speak with you in the few minutes I have. The letter goes into a lot more detail, so please read it. I'm not here representing a particular client, although I represent a number of clients in Kirkland. I've identified 6 issues where I'd like you to take some time to think about this in a little bit more detail about its impacts and how to provide some more flexibility. I understand this is a balancing act between protecting the environment, which is important, but also a huge impact is going to occur on the citizens and property owners of Kirkland, particularly with these huge new buffers. Individuals who bought their homes, who built businesses, will wake up after this is adopted and find that their property is all of a sudden in a buffer that they did not know about. So most of my comments are about some flexibility. Let me just quickly summarize. You provided flexibility to the Public Works Department, which I appreciate, but the same flexibility should be applied to private property owners, and I've identified 4 sections of the code where I'd like you to look at that. Because of the significant expansion of buffers, we need to provide property owners and businesses an opportunity to have some flexibility if you can't meet that buffer setback. It's interesting to note that a property owner could now come in under this proposed code and propose to fill the wetland, actually destroy it. Again, mitigation sequencing, going through all of that, avoidance if it's unavoidable, mitigating the impact. But you don't allow that in a buffer and leaving the wetland intact. You need to provide the flexibility in many jurisdictions, and I've cited several here, that allow what is frequently called a paper fill, where you don't actually fill the wetland, but you intrude in the buffer, but you treat it as if you've filled the wetland, and you have to go through mitigation sequencing and then mitigation if it's an unavoidable impact, but it provides some more flexibility. I'd ask you to expand the interrupted buffer waiver. Again, you've provided for some specific improvements the ability to prove that that buffer has been intruded. Why not allow the flexibility for anyone, for the, whatever the improvements are, to offer that proof to the planning official? I guess the final thing is, I've been working for so many years, the federal government has a separate set of regulations, as you may know. And the problem my clients often face is that the city requirements are completely independent and different than the federal requirements, which often leads to duplicate mitigation requirements. I'd ask you to go back through your regulations as it relates particularly to the on-site in-kind preference, because the federal government says don't do that. Their preference is buying credits from the King County in-lieu fee program, which means individuals may have to go pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to King County to provide habitat improvements and at the same time have to do on-site in-kind mitigation in the city given that preference. Again, there's a lot of detail here. I recognize that my time is up. This is a public hearing, and I understand that you get to this point and you say, okay, it's time for the public hearing, and now let's adopt this or recommend adoption. I'd ask you to take some more time and read my comments, deliberate over them. If not today, spend some more time, go back to staff and ask them to review these issues. These are important issues. I've been working on this for 30 years, and I think this regulation could be improved to provide the protection of the environment but more flexibility to property owners and businesses. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carson. Is there a question? Yes. Question. Yes, please.
Mr. Carson, if I could ask you on the second page. Thank you. Mr. Carson, if I could ask you on the second page of your letter, you talked about the differences between the wetlands and the buffers and how we treat the wetlands separately from the buffers. You'd mentioned we could fill in a wetland, but we can't fill in a buffer. Can you point that out in our code for exact specificity?
Yes, if you go to KZC 90.60.4 through 9.
Okay. And Joan, if you could help us in our packet, that what page that might be on, is it? Just 90.60.1, okay. I just want to understand exactly how that's different.
If you go to 90.60, it's called wetland modification. And it says modifications to wetlands and the associated buffers of those wetlands. It's prohibited unless you go through this process. And the process that's identified allows the wetland to be modified. And again, you under Section C, for example, wetland modification assessment, you have to do this critical areas report, you have to go through mitigation sequencing, you have to go through and do a compensation mitigation plan, et cetera. So your code does allow, if it's unavoidable impacts, to fill a wetland. There's no prohibition in this code on this. There's a prohibition, but a process to allow that. There is no such thing to just fill a buffer. And my point is, ecologically, if a property owner is faced with a situation where they would like to do a development, that development cannot avoid the buffer, or much of the buffer, can avoid the wetland, why shouldn't they be able to do that instead of coming in and saying, well, let me fill the wetland? That makes no sense. And so that's my point.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. I'm stumbling to find that. You'd mentioned C. So it's 90.60.1C.
Point four. 90.60.4 is the process. Okay. So you go through 4 through 9, essentially provides the process to modify a wetland.
Okay.
Is that in our...
Yes, I have it on page 30, well, 18 or 36, depending on which page number I'm looking at.
Okay. All right. So I will go through that. Then the second follow-up, if I...
Yes, please.
...question I had, the second to the last page, your last page is the signature page just before that, the second underlined, it talks about the mitigation requirements for consistency with the 2008 federal mitigation. Now, I understood that we're matching the federal mitigation, and you're mentioning we might not be, so I'm confused.
I'll just summarize it quickly. So the 2000, basically, in the past, like Kirkland and like cities across the United States and states, there was this idea that if you filled a wetland, you should mitigate it on site, that same site, and in kind, meaning if you interrupted a shrub-scrub wetland, you should replace it with a shrub-scrub wetland. That was the theory. And over a dozen years or so, as the federal government looked at this and studied it, they found that those, in fact, were more likely to fail, one, and two, the needs of the environment, the wetland habitat, the watershed, may actually be better served than having these postage-stamp mitigation sites and combine that into a larger wetland mitigation bank or an in-lieu fee program like King County runs, where they do major improvements to the watershed. So the King County has set up this in-lieu fee program, and there is a preference in the federal rule for mitigation banks if they're available, then if they're not, in-lieu fee programs, and then if they're not, what's called permittee-responsible mitigation. And in that, as my letter says at the bottom of page 4, there are three preferences for permittee-responsible. And the number one for that is doing a watershed-based improvement. The second one after that is on-site in-kind. So under the federal rules, if you will, there's six ways of doing mitigation. The fifth preference is on-site in-kind. This draft code says the first preference is on-site in-kind. That's inconsistent. Now, it doesn't. Now, I did note in here that I appreciate that the regulations are proposed to allow use of in-lieu fee. It's the preference that is concerning me, because that could lead to inconsistencies in how it's applied.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
One more question. Can the fee in lieu, just from my own, can it be dedicated to the city of Kirkland, or is it just...
King County runs a program where they identify mitigation sites that can benefit the watershed, and they are watershed by watershed based. So, you know, what typically will happen is there will be an identification of the project with closest to the watershed of Kirkland. But I guess my response is, rather than be parochial about where your mitigation is, let's do what mitigation is best for the environment. And what's best for the environment may not be in Kirkland. It may be in a watershed that ultimately improves, you know, the whole basin, the whole watershed, but it may not be in the city of Kirkland. And that's the base. So no, it may not be in the city. You can't direct it to the... Okay. Thank you.
David Fowler signed up for to give comment on low impact development. Mr. Fowler, did you want to give comment on this topic? Okay.
Oh, your cards. Hi, good evening. One quick comment on the trees. I have acreage in Linwood. I have acreage here in Kirkland. And trees are incredibly important. And to willy-nilly let somebody plant whatever tree they want to replace the tree they take out. Hemlocks have a very poor root system, and they're very poor trees. And they snap off in the middle in the windstorm. They topple over. We had one come down in our property in Linwood, right across our road, cut off our access. We've owned our property in Linwood for about 30 years, and we've lost about 5 hemlocks on 4.5 acres. In the windstorms, they just don't make it. To replace, say, like a good tree, like a cedar with a hemlock, is crazy. And Dixie Lee Ray, she talked, and of course some of you remember her, a wonderful governor, and she said that when you, she spoke actually for harvesting trees, not, you know, clear cutting, but properly harvesting them is better for the ground recovery than deep, dark forests. If you've ever gone hiking through a deep, dark forest, there's no ground cover whatsoever. And the ground cover, you need to stabilize the land and thing and such, and also let little critters and things grow. So replacing 3 trees for 1 tree may not be such a great idea. And like she mentioned, they grow, and some of them grow pretty fast. Okay, just that one comment that I would like you guys to put some thought to. My problem is that I've got 2.2 acres, and over on Slater Avenue, and right now the setbacks gobble up 2/3 of that property. When you go, and this is 75-foot setbacks. And I've got a small stream that goes through there. I don't know if it's fish-bearing. Right now, I don't see any fish because it's 1.5 inches deep, and it's about 6 feet wide. I took some copies, and I don't know who. I've already talked to Teresa about this. And she gave me some wonderful information and helped me kind of recover my sanity. But as you can see, and I don't know who I should give this to. I already gave, Teresa's very familiar with it. Does anybody else need any of this?
We'll share it. If you want to give it to us, we'll pass it around.
Okay.
Thank you.
Eric, would you like?
Yeah, we should probably have it in the record. If you could hand it up, that'd be great. Oh, and Mr. Fowler, your 3 minutes has elapsed, but if I'll give you a little more time if you can.
2 minutes?
2 minutes. Have one.
God, I feel like I'm in court. Well, basically, that's about it. If you extend those buffers, another thing I think that should be taken in consideration is the banks going down to the stream. Now, if it's a fish-bearing stream and there's steep banks on both sides, then the stream going out of its banks and so on and so forth, I don't think the setback has to be as far if there's banks on both sides of the stream than if it's flat or level. So I think the banks should be considered. And with that, I guess my time's up.
Thank you, sir. That's the end of those who've signed in tonight to give public comment. Is there anyone else in the audience that came in late or did not have the opportunity to sign in?
Yes,
sir. If you could state your name and address for the record, and I think there are more sign-in sheets there if you could fill it out when you're done as well.
All right.
Thank you. And if there's anyone else here tonight who did not have the opportunity to sign in, if you could do so now.
Okay. My name is John Clark. I'm a resident of Kirkland. I live in the Holmes Point area. But what I've noticed through all this, I have acreage there, what we call streams. If I were to walk around Kirkland and look at streams that really are streams that have flow all year long and fish and all that, there's encroachment right up to the edge of the water. There's manicured lawn, there's houses. Over in Juanita, there's apartments right next to them. The same rules are being equally applied to roadside ditches that terminate in culverts and originate in culverts. I think there needs to be some consideration for things that were drainage ditches for uphill neighborhoods, and then they terminate into the stormwater system. I don't think they should be called streams, especially if they're not fish bearing. And there should be some allowance for reconsidering that, or I'm not sure if there is. I haven't seen it in here where you could say a stream can be deemed not a stream based on its functionality or. Because right now, basically, if you've got water flows that move sand around or leaves around, that's called a stream. Well, you look at every road in this city, and you've got a stream by the edge of the road. So at what point does this make sense, and are you really creating a good environment or whatever? And also, within the buffer or whatever, if you create rain gardens or some sort of detention system, is that contemplated and allowed? Where you're actually improving the environment, not just saying here's 50 feet on either side, that makes it wonderful. I'd argue that it doesn't, and I would like to see something more clear in this that says an engineered solution is equally as good. So I guess that's my comment.
Thank you so much.
I don't have a question for Mr. Clark, but it's more towards the staff. My question is popped in my head. When we're increasing these buffers, I think I know the answer to this, but is the property owner compensated in any way that they've lost property? Being, reduction in property tax valuations or anything like that. And that might be a King County issue, but I guess I'd throw it out to the staff.
No, we don't have any way to compensate other than providing for some relief through nonconformances or through mitigation sequencing approaches or some flexibility in how they site the property. But there's no monetary compensation for this, just like any other zoning restriction or requirement that we have. Okay. That setbacks, for example, height, for example.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, go ahead.
Question for staff. If enlarging the buffer, would that create a non-conforming situation? Is like you talked about in here. And then So then they could still do these additions.
Right.
Okay, so. Gotcha. Thank you.
Eric?
Mate.
There's a gentleman back there that would like to speak.
Oh, let's. I think there's a question for staff first. But.
And Jeremy, I think, also noted that the county does, when they do the assessment, they take that into consideration, that there may be reduction due to the setbacks or requirements or easements on the property.
What I was asking.
So, okay.
Thanks.
Okay, before we get too deep into our discussion, I'd like to wrap up the public comment. So I think there's another gentleman in the back who would like to. And sir, if you could state your name and address for the record, and when you're done, fill out our sign-in sheet. Thank you.
Good evening, Council's Planning Commission audience. My name is Yasser Khan. I'm a homeowner up in Finn Hill, right off of 134th Street Northeast and 90th Avenue. I'll write my information down. I originally wasn't going to speak, but I feel like just as an average homeowner, after hearing a lot of the discussion, I just wanted to add a few thoughts for consideration. For what it's worth, so hopefully this will come in handy. The reason why I came tonight, away from family and all the other stuff I could possibly be doing, is really out of nervousness or almost sort of a fear. And what I mean by that is when I first got notice of the Chapter 90 amendment going on, I feel like in my own backyard, a place where you used to be able to do a lot of things. I mean, sure, some permitting is required, but you used to be able to do things in your own backyard without really thinking too much about it. I'll wake up one morning, as this gentleman mentioned, and suddenly I'll be thinking, wait, can I do this? Can I not do that? Can I plant this flower? Can I not? Is this 50 feet? Is this 60 feet? And this sense of uncertainty is what's driving me here to ask questions and see how does this really impact me. And thank you, Teresa, and your team. You've been really helpful outside tonight in explaining a lot of these things. But I still feel like until we get more details on what type of stream is next to me? Is it a fish one, a not fish one? Is a wetland a 60-foot wetland or a 75-foot wetland? Where do we draw the tape? Do I need to bring a tape measure? This uncertainty will persist. And so my suggestion is think about it almost from the homeowner's point of view. Like if I got my notice on December 17th or something saying that, hey, these changes are happening, how does this actually concretely affect me at that address? And without which, I fear that the uncertainty will just cause more confusion, both for citizens and for the city. And in particular, we also mentioned that if I wanted to find out how much the widths are, I would have to hire or pay the city or find out more details. And I just feel like this is all removing freedom, if you will, from your own backyard. And that's just an uneasy concept for me to think about. As much as I do like and, in fact, support being environmentally conscious and friendly as the effort is overall. So I just wanted to bring that up, and I hope that helps in somehow in your discussion. Thank you and good night.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone else in the audience who did not have the opportunity to give public comment? Okay. In that case, we will close the public hearing, and both the commission and the Houghton Community Council now deliberate and make a recommendation to City Council. So I think this is our seventh or eighth meeting that the Commission has had on this topic. I know that Houghton has had fewer. So if the Houghton Community Council would like to have any questions or go first in terms of issues they have, we'd be okay. That'd be great.
Anybody? John?
Of course, I'm going to go, right? A couple of items. Overall, I'm really, really happy that we're thinking about some way to easily allow homeowners to do something on their property when overnight they've discovered that, something's happened to my property. I think that's great. Again, as I'm sure everyone can guess, I'm going to plant my flag that it's just not enough. Number one, I looked at the schedule, and from an implementation strategy of this, should it pass council, it's February 2017. And thinking about that, people have had an opportunity to get on listservs, get information. I do think, though, the time frame is just too fast for people to wake up one morning when this is going to be passed. And it's going to happen to people's property. They have no opportunity to really react and think about how they might want to modify their home, go through a remodel, change their property, seek professional guidance, apply for appropriate permits, get seconds on their homes, or get money to do what they need to do on their property by February 2017. So one of the things that I would like to ask is that while this might go through the time frame, push out the 2017 implementation date to allow the public a little bit more time to get accustomed to this, to make plans based on the existing code, that sort of thing, so it can be published, whether that's a month or 3 months or whatever. I think accelerating it 2017 is pretty quick. Next item that I have in the code itself, I'd like to start on the purpose. I am on page 2 or page 20 of attachment 1 under purpose, section 90.10. I did mention in the past that one of the purposes of this seems to focus on protecting the environment. It does, in my mind, inadequately state that it needs to do all of this while preserving property rights of the public. I brought this up last time. There is not necessarily a change. It does say in the second sentence, the purpose of this regulation is to protect environment, comma, human life, comma, and property, period. I don't think that's enough. It goes on to further classify the environment. I think it should restate while preserving property rights for the public. Then again, if we look at the top of page 321, just before item number 2, streams, it reiterates yet again the primary purpose of the wetland regulation is to achieve a goal of no net loss to wetland function, value, and acreage, which where possible includes enhancing and restoring wetlands. Again, I think it should be while preserving property rights of the public. And Teresa, bear with me. Your slideshow was excellent, by the way. I'm sorry, Joan. The way that was put together was great. The exceptions for public utilities is another thing that I read. I believe Mr. Carson mentioned this. I think that's great. I think his comments in his letter deserve a second thought. If I get all the way back to, maybe Joan, you could help me when we talk about the public agencies. And I'm sorry I can't point to a page right now, Joan. I know it's...
That's, let's see, exception. That's on page... 13 or 31? 31 of the packet, 13 of the regulations.
Thank you.
Down at the bottom.
One of the things that I noticed that while we're giving agencies for the public good a laxed or preferred or streamlined method to work within the buffers to install sewers, or clean out grates or that sort of thing. One of the things that I believe ought be added to this and clarified is that should there be a sewer line or a water line or a public utility that the public needs to access for the use of their personal property, that they ought to at least be extended the same right to go down and grab or get that public utility to bring it up to their home. So having the jurisdictional authorities to be able to go into a buffer wetland area and install a sewer and then make a homeowner go through just a knot hole in a fence to go get it so they can use it doesn't seem to be equitable in my mind.
Okay. Can I respond to that for just
sure.
a sec? Okay, if you go to page 10 or 28 of your packet, This is under the heading Permitted Activities, Improvements, or Uses Subject to Development Standards, Section 90.40.6B. So that, again, is on page 10 or page 28. So it's on the bottom of the page, Private Utilities. Okay, have you found that? It talks about what private utilities can are allowed subject to planning official approval. It talks about repair and maintenance. It talks about new sewer and stormwater lines in a critical area buffer where necessary to allow for gravity flow, provided that they're located as far as possible from the critical area edge. It says new utilities other than what's addressed for sewer and stormwater, that the provided that, let's see, that the facilities are located in the outer 25% of the buffer area. It talks about new stormwater outfalls and associated dissipation devices. And it talks about boring for utilities under a critical area. So it has some provisions in there for what can
occur. Yeah, thank you for that. I actually was looking for that and did not see that, so I'll
take a look at that.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. So, again, my point still stands that I think that that should be equitable. So, great.
John, if I could interrupt for just a moment. I think the difference is, Joan, and correct me if I'm wrong, number 6 on page 28 talks about those items are exempt or listed permitted activities so long as they meet the requirements of Section 5,
mm-hmm.
which starts talking about mitigation sequencing and so on.
Yes.
And I think that was Mr. Carson's point, is that if you go to Section G, public agency and public utility activities, they do not appear to have to go through the same criteria as the private user. So I think that's the difference that Mr. Carson was pointing out, and I think that's the difference that Mr. Kapler was trying to raise here, unless I'm missing something.
Yeah. Under G, public agency and public utility activities on page 12 or 30, is
right.
that the ones you're speaking of? That still has to meet all of 5.
Where does it say that?
If you go back up to the beginning of this section, 90.40, on page 9 or 27, talks about the process. It talks about the decisional criteria, and it's number 5, standards. Application for permitted activities, improvements, or uses identified in this section shall demonstrate that they meet all the following standards except as noted in subsection 6 below. So all of number 5 has to be met for all of the things that come after it. So the same requirements are for both the public and the private in this under this section. In other words, you still have to submit. You have to go through mitigation sequencing. You have to do a, you know, report. You have to submit a report and a mitigation plan and. You have to do all the things that are noted in there for both of those actions, private or public.
So does that mean that Mr. Carson's first underlined sentence that you have provided private citizens the same?
Well, I think he's talking about a different process. This is the thing I think that Mr. Carson is talking about is exception public agencies and public utilities. That's 90.45. Is that correct, Mr. Carson?
Well, I think there's several. There's the exemption in 90.35 for maintenance.
Oh, okay.
As well. So public utilities can be repaired and maintained as an exemption, but private can't. And then there's the 90.45 exemption, which is on page 13.
Under private utilities under 6B, repair and maintenance or replacement of private utility service lines and conveyance systems within critical areas. That is a permitted activity.
But the other is an exemption, and that's the point I think that Mr. Kapler was making. One you have to go through the knothole, and the other is just exempt.
That is correct. The public facilities are maintained currently as an exemption, and we've brought that forward into this code. Private ones were not. Yeah, this is generally what is accepted across the board with other jurisdictions as well.
Well, I think it begs the question, what's the rationale for distinguishing between the two?
Pardon me?
What's the rationale for distinguishing between
I think that there is a recognition that the public service or agency service or public utility service serves a greater public good than a private development, and that the justification for an exemption would serve the public's the public good.
Does it assume that the utility is more responsible?
Pardon environment? Me?
Does this assume that the utility would be more responsible?
Sure, sure.
Well,
I think that part of the rationale is also that public utilities are often long, linear. They occur in long, linear corridors, and they may have less flexibility to make those little site adjustments compared to, say, a private connection. You know, you could maybe connect on one side of the lot versus another. So,
I think Mr. Miller had a comment.
But, you know, following up on that, you know, number one, repair and maintenance of a structure is exempt. So I can go out and repair my structure, my house, but I can't repair the road going to the structure, going to my house. I can't repair the water line or sewer line serving the house. That doesn't make any sense. I mean, you're telling me it's okay to maintain my house. If it burns down, I can replace it. But if the sewer line breaks to the house, I can't go in and fix it. That doesn't make any sense.
That one requires a lot more grading?
Yeah, rebuilding my house requires a whole heck of a lot more work than digging the sewer line up.
But they have to have it on the same foundation. So they're basically constructing that up.
Yeah, but you're not going to go in there with a helicopter and just drop the house down on top of the foundation. And your code recognizes that by talking about rehabilitating the wetland, repairing the site after the work is done. I mean, it doesn't make any logical sense to tell me I can repair and maintain my structure, but I can't repair the driveway.
Well, wait, that is not correct. The exemption number one, if you read footnote number one under page 8 or 26 of this packet, repair and maintenance shall not increase the previously approved structure footprint or impervious area, including paving previously approved gravel driveways and parking areas within a critical area or its buffer, and shall not include foundation replacement. So,
no,
and
you said not paving existing gravel drives, but if I have a paved driveway and yes, it starts to crack, I can't repair it?
Yes, you can.
The but existing it appears to be exempt.
The existing footprint can be repaired and maintained of a structure.
But is the driveway part of the structure?
Mm-hmm. A structure footprint, yes.
Well,
impervious area, including paving previously approved gravel driveways and parking areas.
So what about my water line and sewer line that are growing up my driveway?
No.
Or through your yard.
Or through my yard.
It says right here.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't include that.
Right.
Or the rock wall alongside the driveway.
Pardon me?
Or the rock wall alongside the driveway.
So technically, if I have a water service line that springs a leak, I can't go in and repair it until I go to the city and get a permit.
Well, if it's an emergency, you can do that.
And then I get to go to the city and get a permit.
After you pay the fine.
Yeah. It doesn't make any sense. Okay.
It seems like what's most important is the functionality of the wetland. And so I guess I don't quite understand how you know how it's functioning prior to a certain date and then how it's functioning after whatever you've done to it has done. So that's what I think makes it a little squishy or feel like, did I really hurt anything by doing that? You know, so that's where it feels like it's, we're making an awful lot of regulations, but how effective are they? What's the real goal in the end? And that's harder to put into code, I think.
It may be helpful if staff can respond to Brent Carson's comments.
Yes.
And it could be helpful if we had a chance to go through his comments, so that way maybe some of those questions will be answered or issues.
Yes. Did staff just receive this letter at the same time
yes.
we did? So
yes.
You haven't had a chance to digest it, obviously. What is staff proposing for being able to, our goal was to make a recommendation tonight, I think. If staff is going to provide responses, and it seems like there was a lot of interest in the issues raised in Mr. Carson's letter, how problematic will it be if we do not make a recommendation tonight?
That's perfectly okay. We can come back at a future meeting and probably be separate meetings between the two, or we can do a joint meeting again, but we can try to get it on the schedule and come back and get a response, and if appropriate, make changes or recommendations on changes, and then you can make a recommendation individually or jointly.
Okay. Thank you. Any thoughts on that? I know we only just sort of started our discussion, but I feel like there's...
I think Mr. Carson raised a number of significant issues in this letter that would be helpful to have a little more time to have the staff review it and get back to us and have another discussion regarding it.
I agree.
Yeah. Okay.
I think what would be most helpful for staff tonight then would be to find out that the key questions you have that you'd like to come back at that next meeting on.
I agree. I think it'd be helpful if we still continue our discussion for a little while longer tonight. We can flag some other issues for staff to come back to us with. Mr. Pruitt?
Yeah. I support the Growth Management Act. I get why it's important that we do this. I'm all for the city updating its regulations. I'm all on board on that. I am curious about John's comments about the effective date of this. The homeowner comments tonight were something that I related to a little bit. What is the reasoning for it gets approved by the city council and then within the less than a month it gets implemented and homeowners have to comply to it? What basically would stop us or prevent us from having a period of time where there could be a public education piece? I've realized the staff has done a very good job up until this point with the open houses and making sure the public is aware. But I do share the concern that there are going to be many people in this community with plans on their properties up until January, only to learn in February and March that they can't do those plans. And I think that's a concern that when we come back and discuss this, I'd like to know a little more about what the logic is as far as when this is implemented.
So just a couple of quick responses on that. One is that we have been sending out notices to people, letting them know this is coming at some point. We did try to anticipate a transition period and with a action by the City Council in December with effective date sometime in February, so that's 6 to 8 weeks. So, but we certainly can talk about, a little bit longer or something that might work better. So it's okay to kind of think about that and come back. We'll come back and perhaps you want to make a recommendation to the City Council on when that might go into effect. But, we don't want to wait too long, but I think a reasonable time period would make sense.
Yes. What about the possibility of we've enacted new regulations, and for a period of time you could utilize either regulation. How it, you know, this may really benefit some people that are already encumbered, but the people that aren't encumbered, that become encumbered, are the ones that are really going to get hit. And there's nothing like it's been passed. You can say it's going to happen. We're talking about it. But until somebody says it's passed and you're now encumbered, people don't wake up. So is there a way
that
to
could
say
be really
passed it
problematic?
And, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Right. Okay.
Very confusing to people, and it's a little bit, I understand, you know, but we'll try to get some information out to people and make sure as many people are aware of what's happening, and maybe that be more effective and set up some than trying to do two ordinances at once.
You, John, you're kind of on a roll. Are you done?
John's got
not finished. No.
Mr. Singhal, then we'll go back to Mr. Kapler.
Okay. I wanted to comment on an issue that staff raised on page 4 of our packet, which is regarding the time lapse for reasonable use exceptions, and suggests that, well, I'm actually a fan of having these exceptions, prompt rapid movement. I think the staff's reasoning here is reasonable, and that a 5-year period is probably the right course.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Kapler.
Continuing on, now I flipped my page and lost it. Excuse the shuffle. Where did I go? Right. I'm on page 16 or 34 of the packet under other standards. Third bullet down, and this is woven through much of the language in the document. This is where I highlighted it. It states wetlands must be restored that have been degraded by removing debris, comma, sedimentation and or invasive vegetation. I think, first of all, it's a bad sentence in its prose. It should be rewritten to be clarified. Second, the word degraded, I could not really find a definition in our definitions. There probably is some sort of definition in the wetland definition world. However, I look at it as the word degraded really can mean lots of things. I always point to, which we'll talk about in our next subject, the wonderful wetland area by the new Lakeview School that's got the beautiful chain link fence around it that has turned into a rat's nest that's a blight on our community. That's degraded. In my view, that's degraded. So does it meet this definition, a wetland that's been degraded? Now, it might function and rats can go in there and that sort of thing, but it's full of blackberries and I think from a built environment standard and a beautification of our city, it's horrible. It's horrible, and we shouldn't promote horribleness. We shouldn't. and I think this sentence, points to that. So I think it needs a little work. Page 56 or 74.
John, can I follow up? Are you saying that degraded needs to be an actual definition?
It does. It talks about wooded areas and that sort of thing, fallen trees. That's kind of woven, right, Sarah, through the whole. There's language like that sort of through this whole document that I saw that was sort of tied together. It said degraded wetland areas, and I think it should just be defined, because really, what is that?
I'm not sure what you were asking me, but
the language that wetlands have to be restored if they are degraded, and then later in another area I saw that the degraded it further said such as wooded debris falling down. Well, Does that mean if you have a fallen tree, you need to pick it up? Or I don't think it's really saying what you want to say. I just don't. I would prefer that, first of all, wetlands have to be restored if they've been degraded. You can't restore a wetland that's been degraded by removing debris. It should be a wetland should be restored that are degraded.
What it should say is wetlands that have been degraded must be restored by blah, 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 blah.
Okay. Yeah. That would work. Then the pros are right. Yes.
Yeah. But further, the actual what degraded means probably should be defined, and probably be defined by different types of streams or whatever. I mean, one type of stream, you...
Well, I was actually, to your point, you're correct. I was thinking a natural degrading in my Lakeview school example, because I think that's naturally degraded to a mess.
That's an overgrown.
And then there are other wetlands that have been man-made degraded. Somebody threw their old car and the old tires in there. Those are two different kinds of degrading.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? In my mind, both need to be cleaned up. But they're two different kinds of degrading.
Yeah.
And this language doesn't really point to any of that, because I can almost speculate that my example of the Lakeview school degrading probably isn't seen the way I see it. So, all right. Any other comments on that? I'll move on.
Oh, Miss. Yeah, Miss Weber. Did I pronounce your last name? Weber? Weber?
My question is for staff.
Speak into the mic, Elsie.
I know. Huh?
Speak into the mic.
No, I don't. You know me, I hate the mic.
Yeah.
You did a lot of work. You sent out 12,000 property owners' notices within 300 feet of the wetland. Okay, I see that you did that. When did you send out the postcard? Did you give them like 6 weeks?
The notice was sent out before we started the process. So they were sent out in early January, before we had our first meeting.
And had you consider follow-up when it's not, when 10 months have gone by for them to come to our meeting?
We had quite a few people responded who were looking at building or making changes. We've met with many of them. We have over 260 people on a listserv. So most of those people are on there and we've had a lot of applicants come in applying under the current code. So we feel that those that are looking to do something with that notice, so most people like the gentleman tonight, he had his card, that I think we've reached all those people. It may be someone who didn't look at it, and then now they're not even thinking about it, so maybe a few of those people. One issue is the cost. It's very expensive to send out notice to 12,000 people.
Well, I know you did, and I just was wondering when the cards went out originally. And then did it go on the Kirkland blog by any chance, or in the Reporter, or in the Seattle Times, this meeting tonight?
Yes, we had it in, I don't know, our local newspaper. Yes.
Seattle Times.
Seattle Times?
Right. But again, we've sent it to all the neighborhood associations. They've received all the packets. And we went and spoke to CAN and did a presentation, so they are aware of also what's going on. But just by the number of people who've called, who said they're looking at doing something, and those that have all come into the city, we feel that we've probably reached anyone who was paying it, who wanted to pay attention. And again, the number of listservs. We just have a lot of active listserv
people. I knew you did. But I just didn't know when. Okay, thank
you. I also
you.
Think we had something in City Update that
yes,
goes to all
the
households.
Yes, City Updates
so.
Sent out.
Right.
So we had two different articles in the City Updates over the last 9-10 months, and the people received those.
Yes, Mr. Gothard.
One more question. I didn't see, and maybe I missed it, any of the enforcement for all of this. And it makes me think of the whole discussion about tree removal in general, how there's not really, unless it's reported, there's not really any enforcement. And I've been told before that you could just look at satellite pictures. But if there's coverage over top, like my property, for example, in Houghton, from a satellite, you can't see anything under the tree canopy. And so I could do
anything, you wouldn't be able to see how it was in the first place. So I was wondering how we would be enforcing all these.
We have you on record. I'm sorry about that. We do have a section on code enforcement.
I'm not in one of these affected areas, so. Yet.
Section 90.205 on page 78 of the packet. Page 60 of the ordinance talks about the code enforcement provisions. Typically, those are illegal fill of wetlands or encroachments, things like that nature. The tree regulations are a different standard, different code enforcement procedure.
Okay.
But we tend to hear about tree cutting or stream disturbance, wetland impact. We get a lot of complaints about that.
Okay.
So, I mean, if we don't know about it, something in the backyard, nobody complains, obviously, there's nothing we can do about it. But.
Yeah. I didn't want to go to all this work and not have any teeth to use to enforce. So, okay, thanks.
Ms. Pringle? Yes.
What was my question? Shoot. wait, it'll come back around. Daylighting streams. Would this be a disincentive for someone to daylight a stream if they had an opportunity, because it would... it would actually decrease what they could do on their property, but they'd be doing a good thing by daylighting a stream. So is there any sort of mitigation or credit or anything for that?
We tried to address that with this version of the code that says that if we don't have to apply the full standard buffer to it. So if you are required to or choose to daylight a stream, you wouldn't have to meet the standard buffer. So we worked with the Department of Fish and Wildlife on that. There is the ability, if you've seen what's happened in downtown Bothell recently with a daylighting project there, obviously doesn't have full functioning 60, 70, 80 foot buffers on it. And so the agencies have said that's acceptable, and we've written that into our code. So you kind of get what you can, but you don't want it to be so punitive that somebody won't daylight, because it will wipe out the property.
Yes.
In here, it says, that the property's downstream from a daylighted stream that turns into a regular stream. They are not going to be held responsible because of the way the stream is going to wander through their property, etc. Is this going to be recorded with the King County Tax Office or the King County Court? To go against the property, so that long after you're retired and all the rest of us are retired, and some poor person comes down here and goes, I heard that when that stream was, it wasn't supposed to hurt my property, I'm not supposed to have to do anything. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, there are two ways to do. One is to deal with it just in our permit system, because we track those things now better than we used to electronically.
But is it going to be with the county where it's a permanent thing?
Well, we can. I think we've said that we can record something on request. So we can record something that makes it permanent on the property if somebody chooses that.
That was one of my points. I don't think it should be at request. I think it should be a condition that if you are an adjacent property that could be impacted, that it shouldn't be up to them requesting to get that recorded. It should be automatic. That should be part of the process. I think that's the only fair thing to do for those adjacent property owners.
How do you think that would
work? I agree.
There's already provision in here that at the request of an affected adjacent property owner, they will record it.
That's not good enough.
It shouldn't be at the request. It should just be, it's part of the process. It does get recorded.
So the city would take care of
it? Whoever's responsible. Yeah, absolutely. It should just be part of the process. Those people deserve to be protected.
Mr. Kapler, do you have more? Or you just, yes, go ahead.
I am talking about nonconformancies. I'm on page 56 and 74. At the top of the page, B discusses reconstruction, and it states on an existing foundation. So my first comment is that there's some complicating issues with that that may conflict with the building department from the standpoint of rebuilding on an existing foundation. There may be some updates that are required through building codes. The second issue is through casualty damage during fire, often, not always, but often, the heat spalls the concrete. It might anneal the metal and degrade the foundation to a point that it must be removed and rebuilt. It is a tragedy in my mind that should someone lose their home through no fault of their own, that they're then required to meet onerous regulations that their property inherited through future regulations. And that's something that I think should be changed. And the foundation issue is sort of discussed in here. So if the foundation is damaged through casualty, I think people should be allowed to rebuild. If we go down a little further on the page, item C3 talks about financial percentage for evaluation. And if through casualty loss, the 50% mark is often a moving number. In today's economy, the tax evaluation of real property is lagging the actual evaluation. Even if you get a it's a specific name of an appraisal that's designed to appraise properties like this. If you go through that process without a physical asset to have appraised, it's difficult. And then if you get a current appraisal based on photographic evidence, I'm afraid that the marketplace, like we have today, might overinflate the rebuild cost compared to the existing cost and shoot beyond the 50% and damage some people. So I think that particular paragraph needs some work. On its face, it's very easy to say, oh, if you go past the 50% bogey, we need to update. But I'm afraid that there are certain times in our economy when the market conditions, like now, may really, really damage somebody, should their property burn down. So I think we should discuss that. Lastly, on my list, Eric, is what Mr. Carson brought up, and this is a question to staff, regarding the consistency with the federal regulations. And if I could just maybe have staff opine on, do you think we've met that okay, and how Mr. Carson commented on that, or is that something maybe you need to get back to us on?
One comment on that is the section that talks about preference in kind offsite. That's directly out of Ecology's their guidance. It's their ordinance. But if you go to the mitigation section, and we'll get to the page number on that. If you go to the mitigation section, it says that we will look on site, but if it's better to do it off site, they can do it off site. So let me give you the section on the mitigation.
56.
What page is that?
38, 39, 56, 57.
So if you go to 30, so we might as well go ahead and address this for you. Right at the top, there's a section on 39, on site versus off site. Mitigation shall occur on-site except when the city determines that, and then it lists, such as there's no opportunity Or, for example, if you have a category 4 poor wetland and it makes and it's not, doesn't have a lot of value, then it makes sense to probably do it off-site. So there's a lot of opportunity for reasons to have it off-site under this section on off-site versus off-site. So it sort of expands on that.
If I could expand on that, Teresa.
Yes.
So it's true the state and federal preference is for the in-lieu fee and mitigation banks. A lot of cities have seen that that's not necessarily their own interest because that means that mitigation is going outside of the city where the impact is occurring. So the regulation as it's drafted does place a preference on on-site and in-kind. As Teresa said, it allows, if there's a demonstration that there's a greater function off-site, it allows for that. So the example where you would have to double mitigate, basically in the city and through a mitigation bank, wouldn't really, I can't envision an example where that could occur. The state and federal also is a preference, so it's not a requirement. If you could demonstrate that there's better functions on site and in kind.
Okay, any other issues to identify to staff tonight? Knowing this will not be the, yes, Mr. Whitney?
Yeah, section 90.185.5. Let's find that. Page 5876. I just want to see some clarification on each one of these. It says only a one-time, B, C, D, E all have the same language where it says only a one-time expansion is permitted for the subject property. And I want to see some language that specifies that that one-time expansion pursuant to that particular subsection. I want to see that because otherwise you could misinterpret. This could be misinterpreted and say that it's applicable. Any one of these is then considered a one-time expansion, and you're limited to that, and that's inconsistent with what was represented by staff. And so I don't want to have that potential misunderstanding. I want to see it clarified by a reference to that particular subsection. Fair enough.
Mr. Singhal?
I had a clarification question about the trees. In the presentation tonight, it was mentioned that tree removal requires 2 trees or 3 trees, depending on the size of a tree. I'm on page 37 or 55, paragraph D, which is the only reference I could find to replacement trees. So I may be looking in the wrong place, but here it's suggesting that it's somewhere between 1 to 3 trees based on the planning official's discretion. Am I looking at the wrong section, or is there an inconsistency in intent here?
If this section, you're talking about page 37, 55. This is if you, in your wetland, you have a tree that needs to come down, or you fall like a snag.
Right.
So this is in the wetland. The other thing we were talking about earlier, that is in the buffer, and that is when you're going to add an addition, and you decide to put an addition in a certain location, and it requires removal of trees. This is in the buffer. And if you have a tree that you want to cut for various reasons, turns with snag, the snag, you lose the value of a tree. So this just has you replace those trees in the wetland area. And it's based on, depending on the quality of the tree and the species of the tree. So again, if you have a very significant large landmark tree, we would want the three native trees, but if it's a real insignificant type of tree, then they just need to do one. So one's in the wetland itself, and the other one is if you have that addition and you're adding like the 1,000 square foot and you're going to take out two trees, then you need to replace those. And that's, so that's it. These are two different standards for two different locations.
Okay, where is the other standard?
The other one, and again, we changed it because we decided to go a different route, but it's under vegetative, so that would be under, it's in two different locations. And let's see, do we have it in here?
Patricia, that's not showing up yet in the code.
It's actually in here. So if you go to the nonconformance section.
Right, it's one-to-one.
Let's go to the nonconformance, and let's see here, do you have it?
873.
So that is on page 57. You go down all the way down to where you're actually doing the expansion. And let's see, more closer. This would be under, it's on page 57, 75. So under nonconformance, it's number 7 under the general standards. And we first approach, we're going to go to 1 to 1.5. But the problem with this is then the planner would have to determine if it's a well-functioning buffer, but they don't decide that it is the critical area report that does that, and we don't require critical area reports for expansions. So we said, let's not do the 1 to 1.5, increasing how much area you have to mitigate. Let's just focus on the trees, if trees come down.
But the language is not there yet.
No, the language, excuse me, it's the language that Joan was mentioning. That's new language that we decided subsequent to writing this.
I see.
Okay. So we will come back the next time and we'll highlight that new language that just talks about the tree replacement. So apologize for the confusion.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Miller?
On page 1634, the wetland buffer widths, and then that section underneath that says the wetland buffer width alternative. And I was just a little confused. If you do the alternative, which increases the buffer width by 33%, do you have to remove all the structures then to do that, to go to the alternative? Is that,
because then it's
right?
Not a buffer. A buffer has to, can't have, because then you'd have improvements in there and you can't use them, and it's not functioning as a buffer because you have pervious surfaces and stuff in there. So you just have to remove them so that if you have a deck or patio in there, then you can't use it because it has to be a buffer with a fence and you don't go in the buffer. Do you see the distinction? That means that it is
well,
not...
I understand what you can and can't do in a buffer. I'm just struggling with the verbiage in here. And it was when I read it a number of different times, and I still was struggling with just understanding it. So if I'm a property owner and I want to expand my house, like on those various plates that you have back there, I can only do those expansions if I do a standard buffer, or
So you would only be eligible to go with that very, very wide buffer. You choose that because people do not, let's say, want to vegetate.
Right.
We're probably not going to have a lot of people do this because that's a large, very large buffer. But let's say they have a large piece of property and they'd just rather keep it natural. But if they have a shed in there or something like that, to make it a buffer, you can't have any paved structures in there. So they would need to relocate, let's say, a shed out of that alternative buffer, the one that's large but you don't have to vegetate.
So if I don't vegetate it, then I have to remove all the structures. But what if my primary structure is in the, it's one thing to take out a little
then
shed,
you
but
wouldn't be eligible
to do the alternative buffer. So if my primary structure is in the buffer, my only alternative is to do the standard
narrower
buffer.
Vegetated buffer.
Or the nonconformance approach.
Yeah, but the nonconformance approach wouldn't allow me to use the alternative buffer. I still have to do the standard buffer.
Correct.
So if you go to 90.130 on page 53,
says the alternative buffer for critical areas is exempt from meeting the standards in the section, and one of the additional standards in 3A is all existing improvements and structures in a buffer must be removed. So it's saying that the alternative buffer is exempt from doing that, but you're telling me that the alternative buffer has to remove the structure. Are these in conflict? On page 53
of the
9133A. Okay. So that is saying that you're, because up above in 1, it says the alternative buffer for critical area is exempt from meeting the standards in this section. One of the standards for the alternative buffer, all existing improvements and structures in the buffer must be removed. It's this, to me, is saying that if it's a standard buffer, you have to remove the structures. But in 9055.1, the alternative buffer, you're saying that it has to be removed. I'm totally lost now is what I'm supposed to do.
We'll take a look at it and then come back at the next meeting.
I think the intent here was not to allow the structures or any impervious surfaces to remain in that alternative buffer. So I can see your confusion here, because the way that this is written, it says that they'll be exempt from these standards. So we'll need to look at that.
Okay, thank you. There's all that same verbiage shows up in 9065.1, the stream buffers.
Page 38.
Yeah.
So that same verbiage shows up there for the alternative buffer. And then two more questions. On page 54.
Of the packet?
Yeah, 36, 54. On B1, I think for clarity's sake, you have when a new or expanded building footprint or an increase of impervious area totals less than 1,000 square feet, but more than 50 square feet. Because the next section down in 2, you talk about if it's less than 50 square feet. So you might want to insert but more than 50 square feet in there.
Could you repeat where you are?
Okay, on page 54, 36.
So it's section 9134B.
4B1.
Take it down to
between.
Got it. Okay.
Just a minor edit.
No, it's good.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And then on B2, on that same page, for an existing well-functioning buffer, the planning official shall require a greater ratio at 1 to 1.5 of vegetation to mitigate for any impact to a well-functioning buffer. So if I'm expanding my house like one of those plates had, and it's a well-functioning buffer, but my expansion, you know, I've got a yard around my house, so my expansion is going into a yard, mowed grass most probably. So, and it's a well-functioning buffer, so I'm supposed to mitigate the entire buffer or that area that I'm impacting. So I'm going out in some grass, I'm taking up 500 square feet. So my buffer mitigation is 1.5 times because it's a well-functioning buffer? Or?
I think this is that same concept that we haven't rewritten here, but Joan talked about in her presentation, to get away from well-functioning and the 1 to 1.5 ratio and just talk more about the trees. Like if your addition is impacting significant trees, then we're looking more at tree replacement rather than getting into this kind of a metric.
So it's 1 to 1 replacement in area, And if there is also trees that are being removed, they need to be replaced. There's, you know, if there's significant trees.
Well,
so it's not written correctly now. We came to this after this draft was drafted.
So you'll be modifying that then?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Kapler, your hand was up for you.
I had a further question on what Mr. Miller was talking about on page 16 or 34, the wetland buffer width alternative. So now I got confused. If I want to expand my house within a buffer and I want to go out in the backyard, and that's a nice, I have a nice big lawn and a playset. Not a playset. Let me retract the play. I just have a nice big lawn and some pretty bushes and wonderful butterflies and hummingbirds and all kinds of wonderful creatures out there. And I look at the wetland buffer width, and it says on here that I've got to remove all mowing of the buffer. So does that mean I can't mow my grass anymore? Did I not read that right, or does it mean I can't mow my grass anymore?
No, it means you can't use the alternative buffer.
I can't what?
You can't use the alternative buffer.
If I have a big yard, I just can't use the alternative buffer. That's
I think that's what you guys just said, right?
The buffer area. So with redevelopment. If you are doing redevelopment and you want to do the wide buffer, you have to then go along with what the provisions say. Okay. We think most people are going to do the narrower buffer.
I was crossword.
Right.
Apology. Okay.
Okay. Any other issues, comments, questions for staff on this? Mr. Miller.
Going back to that same section, not to beat a dead horse, but could you look at rewriting that so it's really clear?
Which section is that?
That's on page 34, 16, you know, where it says all existing structures and improvements in a buffer must be removed. I think rewording that to something along the lines that,
with redevelopment proposal, or with the development proposal, if you choose the alternative buffer,
right? We can work on that.
Email
to us if you got a thought, Mike.
Okay. Sure.
Okay, I have a question for staff, just procedurally. So we're going to continue our deliberation. I guess I close the public hearing. Do we want to leave it open? What have we historically done?
Well, typically you leave it open for written public comment.
Yeah.
Until you actually make a recommendation. So
right.
You can certainly do that.
Okay.
Or you can reopen the public hearing too if you want.
Okay. I think my preference would be that we allow continued written comment, but we close the oral part of it. Okay.
And I would suggest that we do have a joint meeting to just move this along more. I think we'll be sure to get it done on a more timely basis if we meet jointly to reconsider the modifications.
I was looking at the calendar. I think you have a joint meeting on October 24th.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think.
Was that Tuesday?
That's a Monday, actually.
Monday.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So looking at staff, I think if that will work for everybody, we can do it that evening as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We'll see. I have another commitment that night, another meeting to attend. Okay. Any other questions, comments, issues to bring to staff's attention tonight? No. Okay. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, everyone.
Yes,
who
good comments. Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, who gave public comment tonight.
You want to make a motion to continue?
Yeah. So we'll. I guess we. Would somebody on the commission like to make a motion to continue the public hearing?
To continue the public hearing.
Second.
Thank you.
And just to clarify, that was to continue the written portion of the public hearing.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson seconds. All those in favor of Mr. Miller's motion, say aye.
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 Okay.
Mr. Chair, could we have a 5-minute recess?
Yes. Did the Houghton Community Council want to make a similar motion?
I think it's the Planning Commission's public hearing. So
oh, is it?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay. In that case, we'll take a 5-minute recess and reset for the study session on the low impact development. Regulations. Okay, calling back to order the joint meeting of the Kirkland Planning Commission and the Houghton Community Council. We will now move on to the second item on our agenda tonight, which is a study session on the low impact development regulations. And we have a staff presentation.
Good evening. I'm Stacy Rush. I'm a senior surface water engineer in the Public Works Department here at Kirkland. And I just want to let you know that at any time you can, it's okay to just stop me if I use acronyms that you're not used to, or if I say something that doesn't make sense, just stop me and say, hey, because I know not everybody lives in my little stormwater world. So I'm going to talk tonight about a bunch of different things, but the main thing is our stormwater permit, and one of the big requirements is to review our existing development codes. And to make them more low impact, to make sure that they incorporate low impact development. So that's what we're going to talk about, is the process we went through and what we found and some proposed changes. So the NPDES stormwater permit, NPDES is just an acronym for, National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System. And that started at that starts from the Clean Water Act at the federal level. And in Washington State, the permit is administered by Ecology, and it's the Western Washington Stormwater Permit. And what that permit does is that requires that cities take actions, and as long as we take those actions, then we're allowed to discharge our stormwater runoff into waters of the state. And those actions, there's six different areas where they require we do actions, but the only ones that we're going to talk about tonight are just the ones that deal with runoff from development, from construction sites, and new development. And that there's two requirements that we're kind of working on together. It's the code review and the update to the stormwater design standards. So first of all, I wanted to point out that this is not a Kirkland-specific requirement. There's 94 jurisdictions in Western Washington that are having to deal with this. And so we're all kind of on the same playing field. So a little bit more detail of what this permit requirement actually makes us do. The intent of it, the permit's very specific, where it says to make low-impact development the preferred and most commonly used approach to site development. So how do we do that? Well, the permit is also very specific on actions. It told us that we needed to review, revise, and make effective our local development-related codes, and to make sure that there's no barriers and that everything, that there's no barriers and no ways to... that they need to incorporate and require low-impact development. And then any changes that we find, we need to make those changes by 2016, by December 31st, so this year.
What's a BMP?
Sorry, Best Management Practices.
Thank you.
So the two projects that are going on, the two requirements that are going on that are kind of hand in hand, it's the code review project and the new surface water design requirements. Now the LID code focuses more on the high level LID techniques, and those are needed to be in place so that we can incorporate the new design requirements and the new low impact development facilities that need to be incorporated. And there's other stormwater staff that's working on that at the same time and working with council. So for low-impact development, I don't know how much you guys know already, but low-impact development is just a term that means it's a group of techniques where you're trying to take impervious area and make it act like pervious area. So when you've got roads and rooftops, you're trying to make it act like a forest so that water gets into the ground and it gets some treatment before it is cleaned out before it goes to the natural stream. And these are just some actions. Like it shows on the first half, I don't have a pointer, but the first half of the slide just shows about clustering houses, because that you're going to have less impervious. If you're clustering houses, you've got more space for open space, more area for open space. And then on the right, there's bioretention, which is also called rain gardens, and there's permeable pavement, and then there's infiltration dry wells and infiltration trenches, which is just digging a hole and dumping in rock, and then you can route your water there. So for the code review process, we were lucky that we had two good guidebooks to use. The first one actually came out in 2012 from Puget Sound Partnership and AHBL, and that kind of talked about it in a general sense. And then in 2014, Ecology came out with this integration toolkit. And this was really good for our process because it had lots of sample review forms and gave us very specific topics and things to look at, and it was really helpful, because we do have to print, we do have to set, prepare a report and send it to Department of Ecology next March of the whole process we went through and whatever codes we changed. So we started this process actually the end of last year, in 2015, and our first thing we had to do was assemble a team, because we knew no one person would know everything, so we needed to have people from different departments and different areas of expertise. And then the toolkit gave us a document that listed 12 topics that we should look at and consider. And so every topic had a bunch of subtopics under it. And with those topics, we had to look, and for each topic, we needed to look to see if our codes, if there's ways we could change the code to either minimize impervious surface, minimize loss of native vegetation, or minimize stormwater runoff overall. And so just for an example, I just want to pick the topic of parking. So our first thing, we took the focus sheet. You don't have to read it there on the slide. It's kind of hard to read. But what they did, Ecology gave us a sheet, and it had a bunch of questions like, can the number of required parking spaces be reduced? Or can the parking stall lengths or widths be reduced? Or is the drive aisle wider than required by the fire department? Because all those things will help to have like less impervious area that'll help with to have less impervious area for low impact development. So what we would do then is go through the questions that they suggested. We would look in our zoning code for the codes that related to those items, and then we would look to see if our code looked like it was already there or if there maybe was some gaps that we might want to propose something. And so we spent a lot of time on these tables. We had a lot of spreadsheets because there were so many different topics. And this one I just wanted to point out. You don't have to be able to see that. But what I thought was a good thing to show is that Kirkland, we kind of need to pat ourselves on the back, because we have really been LID friendly, and we've done a lot of work already before we were required to. Because one of the codes under the parking topic, one of the LID considerations was, does your code allow for permeable pavement? So we looked at our zoning code, the 105-100, and sure enough, right there it says, hey, it allows pervious pavement. So we're like, great, there's no gap. But then we looked at, but one of the requirements of this review is not only look at zoning code, but also look at other enforceable documents. So we were looking at our standard plans, and it's like, well, we have a LID section in our standard plans, and we have a detail for porous concrete sidewalks and for driveways, porous driveways, but we had nothing for parking lots. So now that we know under the new regulations where these porous pavement parking lots are going to be required, we really need a standard detail, because that'll help our customers and that'll help staff. So we identified that as a change that we would make, is we will add that to our standard details that gets updated every year. So in this case, it wasn't really a gap necessarily. We were kind of 90% there. There was just a missing link to get us to that 100%. And really, that's most of what we found, is we were most of the way there. We just needed a little bit more tweaking to get the rest of the way there. This just kind of goes through our findings. Like, Kirkland's had skinny streets since the 90s, so that's less impervious surface. We even went ahead and did the zoning code 114 for low impact development that offered incentives for developers to do low impact development, which was actually really good in retrospect, because it gave staff the ability to start learning low impact development for design and for construction. So we're not, because I know other jurisdictions haven't been doing low impact development, and now all of a sudden they're going to have to do it, so they're going to have a much bigger ramp-up time, whereas we're already getting pretty familiar with it. So I'm really glad we did that. We already allow cottage and clustered housing. One of the things that you'll see in 114, we are proposing some changes because now we can no longer offer incentives for something that's required. So that you'll see that come up as a changes. And we're not perfect, so we did find three zoning code chapters that we felt would be beneficial to make some changes. So in that, I will turn it over to Deb Powers. Oh, sorry, yes.
A year ago or so, I don't remember the topic we were discussing specifically, but
But somebody mentioned that the code doesn't allow for grasscrete or something similar. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's, they have it at the international school now in the back lot where it's a metal grid and it lets grass and soil, it's pervious.
We do allow grasscrete.
For driveways, because I
Well, no, we don't allow it for driveways. And it's not, it's in the zoning code that it's allowed, but actually it's a public works requirement. We don't allow it on driveways because we found driveways that get used every day, it doesn't last. The grass doesn't grow and it doesn't work.
It still lets the water come through.
Yes, through the sand and stuff. But so that was the decision by Public Works, is that they wouldn't allow it on something that was daily use. It could be used on parking pads that aren't used all the time or like for a parking lot for overflow parking, but not for driveways. So do you, is that something you want to change?
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense because, I mean, you can have an impervious surface there. It's going to be more, it's going to be worse for the environment, period. Because
it's just you're not going to, if you don't have the grass growing there, the grass helps to hold the soil and stuff that's all there.
The metal grid helps hold the soil.
Yes, the metal grid will hold it too. Because then it's going to be just like a sand or dirt.
But isn't the whole goal in this stormwater, in all of this, is to filter the stormwater through the ground?
Yes, it is.
So it can't get through the ground if it's impervious.
Right.
Which is allowed for driveways.
Right.
But if it.
But that's why there's other options. There's the wheel strips. You can do impervious wheel strips.
I just don't understand why it's restricted.
Because that was a decision from Public Works. I don't know, Jenny, do you have any more information on that?
Yes, Public Works. And it is, again, the pollution concern. It's if you don't have grass there, you basically have exposed soil, which is an erosion hazard. And the metal grids do something to hold the soil in place sort of on a mass level, but the surface of that soil is very likely going to continue, especially if it's on any kind of a slope. You're going to continue to see erosion coming off of that area. So,
okay.
Yeah.
When was the international school remodeled, guys? About 5 years ago? So when did you guys change that?
So I don't know the details of the international school, but we've had many schools that have used it for, say, fire access roads.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's in the back.
Yeah,
yeah, and overflow. Yeah. For stuff that's not driven on every day and have the daily use. Because I know we allowed it a while ago on driveways, and we just found they just were not holding up.
Oh, okay.
So that's the only restriction is residential driveways.
Okay, thanks.
So
I have another question about getting back to the parking. Seems to me if we're concerned about the amount of impervious surface, we could have a parking maximums too. I don't know if that's been considered. It's sort of.
I think we do have parking maximums. We don't. We have parking minimums, but not maximums.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was one of the questions that came up that was one of the ones they asked us to look at. I could look at the sheet and see what we said about it.
We have parking minimums, and you'll recall we just recently went through that exercise of right-sizing our parking requirements and didn't think there was an appetite for reducing parking standards any further.
I'm not talking about reducing the minimums. I'm saying conceivably you could say, I mean, just to throw out a number, you could say no one can, at least no commercials, structure can have more than 125% of the minimum or something like that. You could do something like that. And, just an idea. You know me in parking. Anyway.
Okay, thank you.
Do you want to get, okay. Okay, Deb.
Thanks, Stacey. That's cool.
Good evening, Deb Powers, urban forester. So Stacy was right with the city's tree codes are an example of how Kirkland has been proactive with regards to handling its stormwater runoff in regards to the city's tree code, which is Kirkland Zoning Code Chapter 95, also titled as the Tree Management and Required Landscaping Chapter, since it has a element of retaining trees to maintain a 40% canopy goal and keep a healthy in pursuit of a healthy, sustainable urban forest, there are a lot of aspects of the zoning code Chapter 95 that are already handling stormwater runoff just by the way that the tree retention or replanting is required, especially in the eyes of ecology or what they were asking for as far as gaps. So the proposed amendments that we had that were prompted by the gap analysis was to strengthen the connection between low-impact development and their requirements and the urban forest. As Stacy explained, there's a lot of the elements between, as an urban forest being soils, vegetation, and trees, those are a lot of the elements that LID was looking at as far as reducing stormwater runoff and contamination. So we looked at some of the prompts that ecology gave us, and one of them was to revise our tree credit tables so that it incentivized conifer retention and replanting because of the stormwater and retention of, or I'm sorry, mitigation of stormwater that occurs in a more superior way with conifers, and that we wanted to support the best available science and best management practices. That this is another, as technology or research findings come out, the connection between surface water runoff, we're being able to quantify how much soil, how much vegetation, how big of a trees does the interception. So we're incorporating a lot of that, especially the language about soils that ecology had us look at, into possibly the language that was already, well, the language that was already in the zoning code, but not, it wasn't drafted, or the Chapter 95 part of the zoning code, drafted in the way that it's through the lens of surface water or LID. And we wanted to make sure that our pre-approved plans that Stacy mentioned are consistent, kind of connected, that we've got to overlap that with using that lens of LID. We also needed to address some of the issues that were not clear, you know, now that we were looking under a low-impact development lens and looking at other requirements and making them consistent through the Chapter 95. There is also, we proposed some amendments that where there's a preference for use of native species, plant species, not only in retention but also in replanting, and that we wanted to clarify that rain gardens and LID facilities that Stacy mentioned, they count in the required landscaping part of Chapter 95. Instead of, you know, it's just not all by itself, that they are connected to each other. So, and with that, I will, unless anyone has any questions in regards to Chapter 95 and the proposed amendments.
Ms. Cohen?
So, in terms of this 40% canopy goal, I know from the park board that the majority of the canopies in the city of Kirkland is actually held in private property. And what I live on Rose Hill, which is going through a huge turnover of homes that were built in the 50s and 60s now, and on larger lots that are being short platted. And enormous conifers are coming down. One was just taken down today, 2.5 feet in diameter. Two homes were built on a short plat directly adjacent to my property. The plans that were approved stated that an arborist should be on site, and a magnolia that was significant in size should be retained as a part of that. The magnolia came down, and there was not a replacement tree planted. And as far as I know, there was no arborist on site ever. And the builder, there's a significant conifer on the property line, and the builder piled up tons and tons of soil around the base of the tree, which of course is a problem for that tree. So I guess what I have a question about, or what I am concerned about, is how do you keep this goal in mind when there's enforcement is so challenging, and most of the tree canopy is actually in the hands of private property owners? I mean, I understand that low impact development will help with some of this if that's the first thing, but even the fundamental enforcement today is, you know, I like I said, it, I don't think it happened.
I think I could probably defer to Paul on, as I understand it, a staffing or as an enforcement and a staffing issue is how I'm understanding that. Or because there is the tree protection codes are in place, and why the Douglas fir, I don't know whether it was required to be retained. And if it was, why it wasn't fenced off, and why all of those are code enforcement issues that it should have been. You know, there are rules already in place where stop work, or it would have been a code enforcement issue. Why that didn't happen, and why the tree that was the magnolia that was supposed to be retained was not. I can't account for that project, and I know that there are projects that the codes are not adhered to, or the tree retention was the tree retention fencing was moved, and you know that happens, and there is, I would acknowledge, you know, always a perfect scenario as far as enforcement stopping it or preventing some of that. I don't know if Paul, you want to address that as far as the staffing issue?
Like you say, well, I don't know the particulars of that case. Maybe some follow-up needed to be done on that. But, you know, we try to do inspections. They have requirements. If they're not being followed, and we know about it, then we can pursue that. In terms of the canopy goal, we have a combination of the tree regulations, our forest restoration programs, and tree planting. So we try to look at that canopy from a broader perspective. Every so often we have to do the assessment, and then we determine if we're making progress or not. But for that particular situation, I don't know, Colleen, what exactly happened. You can certainly contact the project planner.
The reason that I asked the question is that there is a finite capacity in the publicly held lands by the city,
yes,
within the city limits,
right?
So, and if the majority of the canopy is on private property, and as the city redevelops in some of these areas that haven't been redeveloped before, I note examples in my own neighborhood, for whatever reason, I'm not blame laying, I'm just saying that the codes aren't adhered to. This happens all the time, right? Somebody builds a retaining wall over 3 feet in their backyard and doesn't get a permit, right? I mean, that happens a lot for homeowners. But in terms of this 40% tree canopy goal, how... The LID will help, but what else will be done in addition to this is more what I'm saying, you know.
I think that's a much broader conversation for the, we have an urban forestry strategic management plan. We have a work plan that we put together. We briefed the council on this last month, and we'll be monitoring. We have performance indicators we're looking at as we go along, so... this seems to be a continuing issue in terms of this balancing between property development and people's interest in retaining trees. It's a constant struggle.
And if I could add, as far as the working towards the canopy goal, that 40% canopy goal, and where did that come from, and is that effective? We did have a canopy analysis done in 2011, and which showed, with because as a result of various various actions that the city has taken with frontage improvement requirements with development, as well as the restoration efforts on open space, publicly owned open space in Kirkland. In addition to the changes in canopy showed a trend of an increase on private property as well, and overall and in different segments. So that is, although the analysis of single family to open space has, you know, it wasn't done in an empirical way, it was certainly, we could derive from that the canopy gain, that we're doing something right as far as the measures in addition to Kirkland's tree codes.
Question, just a technical question on your table on page 65. The example, I'm looking at the modifications that were made to the code or being proposed. When you have, like if you need 5 tree credits for a 7,200 square foot lot, okay, and so if you were to take 1.5 times 3, that gives you 4.5. Is it rounded up to meet the 5? Or does it have to?
I think so, right. I mean, that's procedurally what we've done in the planning department as far as how, if that's still consistent right now, I would say yes.
I thought that was the case. And so in your example, I would suggest that instead of saying that that saved 7,200 square foot lot would exceed the required 5-foot tree credits by retaining one 16-inch conifer, I'd say it would meet it by retaining one 14-inch conifer just to make it look more attractive.
Right.
Right.
So there's a myriad of examples that we could use, but yeah. That could be, you know, especially if it emphasizes the point of conifer retention.
That's the point. Yeah.
Right.
I'm just saying, make it look more attractive by doing that.
Okay. So, and with that, I'll introduce Dorian, who will be talking about some other code changes through.
Hello. Yeah, there were also changes to chapters 114 and 115, or there are proposed changes. Chapter 114 is the low impact development regulation chapter that Stacy mentioned that was created in 2008 to promote LID facilities when they were not required as part of traditional development. And the regulations also provide for other incentives for beneficial things like a 40% open space requirement, clustering of houses, retention of native and undisturbed vegetation. But now that the LID principles and facilities are required in the surface water design manual, the incentives need to be removed because now they're requirements. So attachment G to the staff report shows what those text changes would be so that the zoning code would be consistent with the surface water manual. And for example, instead of requiring that stormwater runoff from only 50% of hard surfaces be controlled, the revised text would state that runoff generated from all surfaces should be controlled to as much as feasible. Another change potentially proposed to this chapter would be to simplify the approval process for 2- and 3-unit homes as another incentive. So that is also shown in attachment G, which would reduce the review process for 1, 2, or 3-unit home to a planning official decision and for more than 1, 2, or 3-unit home to a process 1. And then in chapter 15, which includes miscellaneous standards as well as the lot coverage standards. there are some additional changes proposed. And lot coverage is the term that is used to for materials that will not allow for the percolation of water into the underlying soils. And the regulations state that the area not included in lot coverage must be in open space. So I've provided those definitions here, and those were also in the packet. This section of 115 also provides exemptions and exemptions. So exceptions to the lot coverage calculation are that are provided are things like pervious areas under eaves or relatively small landscaped areas over subterranean structures if certain conditions are met, those kinds of things. And then the exemptions section includes things that are incentives for the use of LID techniques. And they include permeable pavement or grass modular grid pavement, that kind of thing. And so the proposed amendments, because of these changes with the Surface Water Design Manual, include, well, the first two are really for clarification in the exceptions section. One would be to add a new exception for rockeries and retaining walls. And this is something that is already typically accepted in plan review, but it's not clear. And then this language would also clarify that anything within 12 inches of another impervious surface, such as a patio, building, or parking area, would also be included in that exception, because we've had situations where in plan review people are asked, well, this is, you know, there's a one-inch gap. Is that still included? And that kind of thing. And then the second new exception would be for public sidewalks if located within a public easement on private property. And that's to enable, provide more flexibility for, with the changes that are being made to the pervious sidewalks and all that. If a public sidewalk were to be located on private property, it would be next to a pervious area of the private property. So it's kind of an even exchange of pervious and impervious land. So that would be regulated also through the Surface Water Manual requirements. And then...
Clarification on that real quick. Would you go through that public sidewalk located in an easement again? Because I didn't hear what I read.
Yeah, I think Stacy will.
Yeah, I can explain. This one came up. Hi. Talking to hear. This one came up because what we're looking at, the requirements under the new manual for sidewalks is you're either going to have to do porous concrete sidewalks or you can do traditional impervious sidewalks, but then it'll need to drain, be sloped and drained to a bioretention area. And the bioretention areas are going to be bigger than the standard 4-foot landscape strip that we have now. So our thought was then if we're going to put in a standard sidewalk, we might need to move that sidewalk out of the, there might be cases where there's not quite enough right of way, so the sidewalk might have to be moved onto the private property, but we didn't want to penalize that person and count that towards lot coverage. And the trade-off is because you're going to have pervious in the right of way that normally would have been the impervious sidewalk, and then you'll have a little bit more impervious. So the overall for that area, the impervious and pervious will be the same, but we didn't want to penalize the property owner just because we had to shift the sidewalk over a little bit. So that was the reasoning behind that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of a new house that went in our neighborhood, which is ginormous. And I understand what you're saying about all of this, but when you're already taking up most of the lot with your house, and then you've got the sidewalk there, pretty soon you've got very little open space at all. Have we, heaven forbid, thought about maybe decreasing lot coverage?
That's the big question, because with all these low impact, the biggest thing for low impact development is to have less impervious area. And right now, most single-family residential anyway is 50% lot coverage, but then there's other areas that are zoned 80% or they're zoned higher. So that's going to be up for you guys to decide if you want to start looking at lot coverage. Our team felt like that was not a decision that we could make or anything, because that's a controversial issue. But that is the biggest
the biggest way to have to get more water into the ground is to have more open area.
Well, and I, you know, and I look at these older homes like mine that are on a large lot, little house. Whoever buys my house is going to tear it down, put up something giant. I mean, it's almost like people who choose not to maximize should get some kind of an incentive, perhaps, somehow, you know, for not just maximizing out to the 50%.
Jenny,
lot
do you want to address that?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And in the new surface water design manual, there are some options for reducing your lot coverage as a flow control BMP or as a low impact development facility. And you could put
an
a covenant on your
home?
Property. Well, not an existing home, but for a new home, if you're...
See, I'm talking about existing homes.
Oh, I
see. People who are choosing to retain an older home and not, you know...
So an incentive, you'd be talking about like a reduction in the stormwater utility or something? Or
yeah,
would it be
I was thinking, possibly.
That's actually a really interesting idea. And over the next year or so, Public Works staff are going to be reviewing possible... LID incentives that we could build into the surface water rate structure.
Yeah.
So I'll definitely take note of that. Yeah.
Great.
Okay. Meanwhile, we're very proud of you all for doing your part.
I have a little house too, and yes, huge lot.
That's right. Okay. And so those were exceptions, and then there are also exemptions, and these are the ones that I mentioned have been incentives for LID, for the use of LID techniques. And now that those are required requirements instead, it's not appropriate to retain incentives in the zoning code. So the proposed amendments would eliminate this section. So then there was also, in the staff memo, we requested direction on the topic of lot coverage and open space, and with the goal of developing amendments for your consideration at the hearing in October. And since that time, we've realized that there are a lot of issues involved in this, and it really will take more study. And these amendments are not critical to include with this code, LID code update. So we'd still really appreciate hearing your thoughts, just informal thoughts, to include in our future study. But we wouldn't propose to bring back amendments on this topic right now. So what this is the zoning code does regulate lot coverage and the elements that are to be considered in lot coverage, like walkways, all kinds of things. Anything that is impervious, and then also provides for, it also states that anything that is not in lot coverage must be in open space, and then we have definitions for that. And then for non-residential uses, there is a section that provides standards for how the open space should be planted, and including requiring that living plant material should occupy, cover at least 80% of that area within 2 years.
Where did you come up with that? How did you come up with that 80%?
I don't know. It's in the code. It's actually older than I am, probably. I'm sure it's just that it's, you know, that is supposed to be the open space on the site. So that of that 50% or what it, this might be in a commercial area that might have a, say, a 70% lot coverage. So that would only leave 30%. So 80% of that 30% would need to have living plant material within 2 years.
And how is it? I'm just curious. How is it calculated? Is it like
just living? So, you know, then you could have 20% that might be
well,
in bar.
I think what Rick's question is like: you have a tree, but then you have dirt right under
the
it.
Dirt is would be not living.
But I mean, if you have plants like bushes and stuff, like so many of the things we have in planting strips or whatever. But if there's a bush and there's some dirt under it, that isn't.
Oh, you mean?
What if there's a whole lot of like that tree, that bark?
Maybe
and,
Jeremy
like, a little
has
plant
it.
Here and
no,
a little plant
it.
Here.
Yeah.
Is that?
First to say, we really don't fuss about this that much because projects in Kirkland tend to be pretty well landscaped. So this might have been written in a different era where some shoddy landscaping was going in. But it really, I think, in terms of what you see planted in the field, it's really probably bark, beauty bark versus actually planting trees and shrubs. So if you have a tree with a canopy, that is counted as covered with living material versus if you have a blank spot with no grass, no shrubs, no ground cover, and it's just bark, that would be part of the 20%.
Have you seen the TOD down at South Kirkland Park?
Well, I'm just saying, having planted a lot myself in my properties that I've been responsible for, you know, it takes a few years for plants to mature and fill in. And if you're required to have 80% coverage within 2 years, then the plants are going to overgrow. It seems illogical to me to have that kind of requirement. If you're looking at where that it's going to give you 80% coverage within a reasonable maturity schedule, fine. But 2 years isn't going to give it time to mature.
Yeah. Okay. This regulation is older than any of us.
Yeah.
and it hasn't been an issue. But if it's something we want to tweak with this project,
I don't know. Maybe you guys haven't been enforcing it all that strictly.
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably not.
We're not going back after 2 years and measuring.
There you go.
That section has some other parts of it that we might want to look into too. So we might include that in the next, like one of the exemptions is area that is committed to some specific purpose, which is really vague. So that might be something we'd want to come back to. So, so since the goal of these changes and this clarification of lot coverage is to avoid conflicts with the surface water manual and to simplify the plan review, some of the regulations in the zoning code that we're thinking that we might want to look at would be, well, first really determine what is the, since the lot coverage is being dealt with through the surface water manual as far as dealing with the runoff and installation techniques of different elements, that perhaps the zoning code should instead regulate open space and kind of determine what are the objectives for that open space. Is it to provide some area of the site that's free of building mass, or does it have to do with the character of the area, like how much open space should be in the area to be consistent with other existing development, or is there a certain amount of open space that is desired? And now it's 50% of each. And so if we were to sort of stop regulating based on lot coverage, we could instead have our requirement be that there should be 50% open space. And then we could really work with that side of it rather than now in planners are expected to, you know, calculate sometimes all the rocks in more of like an alpine landscaping design. You know, are those rocks, you know, should that be open space or lot coverage? And if we could instead define what can be in open space, you know, it could be a lot more flexible and avoid kind of really challenging calculations. So,
well, unfortunately, your example of an alpine rock garden would be non-pervious for the swim manual and count as impervious surface.
Yeah. But rocks, in our other example, we were showing that rockeries, if they're surrounded by turf, the water runs off the rocks into the earth. So if there's earth around those rocks, that could be open space.
I'm thinking of a recent example where we were contacted by someone from a code enforcement standpoint because they put a large mountainous rocks in their yard and took up grass area, and it exceeded their capacity for coverage on their property, and code enforcement made them take it away, and they spent a fortune doing it.
Yeah, and it's also it's very hard to be consistent from one property to the next. So that's something we'd like to revisit and try to fix these issues. So that we're thinking that in the future we would perhaps like to flip that, and instead of regulating lot coverage, we'd regulate open space. And then, but there would be other issues like it's on the screen, like artificial turf. Is that a material that should be allowed in open space, even if it is pervious, or should there be restrictions on things like artificial turf? And then should we also, in non-commercial areas, have a requirement for a certain percentage of coverage of living plant material? So those are the kinds of issues that we would be looking at in the study. So if you have any thoughts. So
we're not, if I'm understanding correctly, as part of this update, we're not going to be changing this open space first?
No.
Okay, this is, will be on our work plan in the future? What's the thinking?
Yeah, I think it would either, excuse me, either be in the miscellaneous code amendments this year or next year. Mm-hmm.
Probably include that with our next round of code amendments.
Okay. Mr. Kaplan?
And if I could, Duran, just on this particular item, one item that I'd like to suggest be added is that the open space and planting requirement of parking lots still has, when I read through the code, still has, you know, every certain number of stalls, we have a tree spot, and we have this and have that. Recently, I was in Austin, Texas, and went to a new shopping center area that had been developed on the outskirts, and took a different approach to the parking in that it was very large areas of landscaping, and then they had larger areas of paving. Mm-hmm. But the larger areas of landscaping could mature into something that was a visual destination, and not, unfortunately, because of the way we have to plan for commerce and these little landscape strips that get the little thorny bushes to keep people out. They turn into, you know, these mazes that people snag their clothes on, and nothing grows, and they look horrible, and they look trampled, and you
get and, a lot of trash in them.
I was amazed at how beautiful this new shopping center parking lot looked, where there was a large amount of parking, but these giant visual little mini parks out there, and that could have big trees with nice canopies and bushes and. And not in such a way that it would hide, you know, perpetrators of evil. But, I mean, they were beautiful. They were really beautiful. And the way this current code is written in the parking section doesn't allow for that. Maybe, you know, rethinking the box might be nice.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Any immediate reactions to artificial turf?
I don't think it's a substitute for grass.
Okay. So Stacy is going to come back for a few more.
Yeah. I think I have one more slide. I was just going to say that we were making some other changes besides the zoning codes. Our standard plans that we call our Public Works pre-approved plans. Those are development standards that we use in Kirkland. And we picked that, we have a whole list of various changes, but some of them are examples, like one of the ones we're looking at is writing a new policy on when permeable pavement will be used on streets and alleys. Because we really haven't had, we've had some private streets that have been permeable pavement, but we haven't really had any alleys or public streets. But there's going to be some new requirements for that. So that, but we want to really think it through and have a policy, because that'll help both staff and our customers. And then also another one is modifying the existing street tree policy, and that's just expanding the street tree selection list so that it includes trees that can be grown in a bioretention area, so that if somebody puts in their sidewalk and puts in their bioretention area, they can put a tree there, and that'll count double for both their stormwater and for their tree requirements. So those are just kind of some examples of it. And we had one, we were also looking at the municipal code, and the only one we found that we really needed to change was more of like a housekeeping thing. There was some inconsistency between what the zoning code referred to for specifications and what the municipal code, where the zoning code referred to our Kirkland pre-approved plans, but the municipal code still referred to a 1977 APWA publication. And so we want to change that.
Stacey, yes. Question on the permeable streets.
Mm-hmm.
Like Public Works has these things where they go through and they put on the surface, you know, the tar or whatever and stuff like that. So wouldn't that...
You're talking about the sealants and things like that?
Yeah,
you can't seal pervious pavement.
Yeah, I was going to say, how does that gonna affect all of that?
Yeah, and I don't know that we've decided what we're going to do for public roads yet exactly, because the requirement is you either do a porous You either do porous pavement for the road, or you route, you do traditional impervious and you route it to bioretention areas along the side or something, or some kind of infiltration along the side. So that may be what we're going to do more.
Well, how do impervious streets hold up? I mean, do they have the same track record? Or?
So I think there's a lot of concern and a lot of skepticism. And as part of the surface water design manual adoption, we've been trying to get our arms around, you know, how do the construction costs vary? How do the life cycle costs vary, and how do the maintenance costs vary? So far, what we've seen is that the life cycle of permeable materials is a little bit lower than traditional concrete. So if, you know, a sidewalk lasts 20 years if it's made out of traditional concrete, it might last 10 years if it's made out of pervious concrete. And the maintenance needs, it sort of depends on where it is. If it's in a very shady area, you might get a lot of moss and issues. If it's in a sunny area, you might not. So, and it may need vacuuming, for example.
It does need.
That's the recommended. So there, I think there's a lot of skepticism, a lot of concern. Some of our neighbors are doing some interesting things in terms of saying, no more, you know, we don't want pervious concrete. Instead, we're going to slope traditional concrete, as Stacy said, to bioretention. So we're definitely looking at that with a very careful.
But then it means you have to have enough right of way to have those bioretention areas along the side, and you have to have maintenance workers that are going to maintain those bioretention areas and stuff. That's a different set of skills versus cleaning out catch basins and pipes.
You just have to have people not take up 50% of their lot with their house, and then you'll have more retention. The other thing was
tree
the
houses.
tree houses would be very. The other thing on this, I know something in here about street trees, and this brought it up, the bioretenting street trees. Just would warn against the conifers as street trees, just because I think those can.
Yeah, we don't allow conifers as street trees.
Okay, I just wanted.
And so that would not be on
good.
The list.
I just didn't want that to sneak back in there because it's not a good street tree.
Yeah, no.
There are some what are called umbrella pines that we're looking into as possible street trees because apparently they have a higher canopy. But it's still in the exploratory phase, I would say.
Closest.
Can I go back to the cost and maintenance issue a little bit? Because that's my concern when we talk about LID. I'm all supportive of the concept. I think it's in line with the values of this community, no doubt. But in many cases, it does not last as long. And in many cases, if it's not maintained appropriately, it does not stay permeable. That's the reality. In fact, many jurisdictions in our region have pulled back their LID. Because they did not have the infrastructure to place to maintain it appropriately and to make sure that it stayed what it was supposed to be. That's part of this process, and that's part of the considerations as we're going through with these code changes, as we're thinking about that.
Yes, definitely.
Just a few comments on that. Again, with the Surface Water Design Manual, we went to the City Council on September 20th with a study session, and what we came away with was actually a recommendation to adopt the King County Surface Water Design Manual, which takes a much more conservative approach to LID than the Ecology Manual, which is all our alternative. Meaning that, you know, it's like let's try low impact development, see as you know how much we can do with it, but let's also put in some fail safe detention facilities if we have issues with LID in certain cases. So,
And another one of the reasons we went with the King County manual, because the ecology was for streets, the first thing you have to look at is doing porous pavement for local roads, local public roads, under 400 ADT. But if we go with the King County manual, you can choose which one, whether you do porous pavement or bioretention and stuff. So at least we have some choices. But ecology's definitely pushing porous pavement, but we are concerned about it.
And public utilities are not a fan of that. And the reason they're not is because if you put a porous paved road over a water line where the ground between the line and the road is not like normal ground, you are liable. There's a lot of sinkholes, construction problems, maintenance problems, things of that nature.
Yeah, and that's why we're...
Yeah, the permit has said very clearly that... surface water design and surface water design principles must start to look at LID. That said, I think there's a lot to work out about how we do it. And finding the ways that make sense. So.
Thank you. Remind me, am I correct, on at least on private property, where we've allowed some pervious surfaces?
Mm-hmm. We have.
It still counts as 50%. Is that correct?
Yes. Yep.
Okay, thank you.
And then
You might mention up to a level because there's a limit.
No, it's 50%.
Well, he was saying, pervious materials count as 50% of the coverage, but there's a limit to this total square footage that you can use in that 50%. So for single family properties,
I thought you were talking about private roads.
Yeah. You're talking about single family properties or private roads?
Well, let's talk about single family property, actually.
Oh, for single family property, yeah, it counts as 50%, but then you still have to meet your overall lot coverage, but you get a little bit of 50% break.
And you can't go over 1,000 feet.
But, John, you're saying you can't use it for... Yeah, it counts as... So 100 square feet counts as 50 square feet, but, John, is you saying there's a limit to the number of square feet?
It's 1,000 square foot for a single-family lot.
Is it?
Yeah. You can't, for example, cover your entire lot with pervious pavers.
Yeah.
Okay.
That would not be...
Yeah. Nobody would want to do that.
Right. Because that's 50%. Hey,
look at that. No house. Yeah. So for next steps, we are going to come back to you on October 24th. We're going to do for a public hearing. We're going to do a public workshop the hour before, and then at the public hearing we'll find out if people have concerns. And hopefully by then we'll have worked through some of these things and we'll have the recommendations. We're also, in the meantime, we're going to be going to, next week, we're going to be going to some of the subcommittees that have Kirkland Council members on them, the Public Works, Parks, and Human Services. That's next week. And then the Planning and Economic Development one on October 10th. And then we're scheduled to go to Kirkland City Council on November 15th. And right now that's scheduled as a new business item. So it's not for final approval. I think we're going to kind of talk to them in the council committees if they have concerns or something, if we need to come back in December. So that's why this slide says that we want to come to you in November 28th, but we can't do that if we have to go back to Kirkland Council again in December. So that's kind of, that hasn't quite been figured out yet.
Isn't that really close to Thanksgiving?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, because you guys don't have a meeting in December, right? Isn't that what...
The only
reason why we're pushing it is that technically we're supposed to have these changes implemented by December 31st. So for to stay in compliance with our permit, with our stormwater permit with ecology. So we're trying to kind of squish it in under the wire.
Did you say that there's another open house before the joint public hearing on the 24th?
Yes, on October 24th.
Should we attend that or should we not attend that?
No reason not to.
If you want to.
I think it's your call. You can attend. Sure. That's the whole purpose. That we kind of like what we did tonight. We had the display boards and we were able to answer questions and talk to people. So
Is it at 6 o'clock and then our meeting's at 7? Is that the way it works?
That's typically how we do it, yes.
Okay, so it might be a good idea.
That's what we're planning.
And if you have any questions ahead of time, you know, call Stacy or
Definitely let us know.
Or Deb, you know, so
yeah,
sure.
So I think that's it.
One last question, Mr. Capper, I think.
I got some questions. So in your presentation, it's going to be easier for me to point to on page 8, under the miscellaneous standards, you've got definitions for maximum lot coverage. And so this just clearly says the maximum percentage of surface water subject to property not covered with materials did not allow the percolation of water in the underlying soils. Many cases we've had to chat with clients about on remodels, you know, you've got pea gravel in front of your little shed in the back and water won't go through that according to the rules. So clearly water percolates through it. Everybody can see that. However, by definition, according to the standards, it's not permeable. And I think that's what ought to be added here is that which do not allow the percolation of water in underlying soils as defined by the standards. To make it really clear.
Okay.
That so you don't people don't ask the question.
I think the idea that is being proposed though is to sort of move to open space as opposed to, I guess what
yes.
my impression is we're trying to get away from the arguments about what is a pervious and not pervious material and find a sort of different or better way
that,
to do yeah. things. And so I think that's what the some of the proposals are.
So there'll be some more
be.
Work on that then. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Yes.
All right, great. And then the next item that I've got is there's a lot of discussion in the regulations regarding creating rain gardens for runoff surface and that sort of thing. You mentioned today that there's also infiltration. Mm-hmm. It's not, I can't really find it to the same specificity as I can the rain gardens and such. And I think the general statement is that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And you know, Stacy, that I really think we need to keep water on site because the bugs mm-hmm. and bunnies need it a lot more than pipes mm-hmm. do to run it downstream. So we need to keep it on site and figure out a way to do that. But personally, I know a lot of people, they don't want a bog in their yard. Okay, mm-hmm. Now, I've got one in my backyard. It's in my backyard, but I don't want one up the street. I just don't. So where the soils allow, promoting infiltration and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. I think ought to be discussed a bit more. In
the
this.
Zoning code?
I really do, you know, by promotion, because right now this really on the face of it looks like, you know, we're promoting bogs in your front yard
yeah,
as
no,
opposed
that's not
to an overall strategy of keeping water on site through best management practices.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of ways to do that, and infiltration is just as viable as mm-hmm. other items when soils allow, and even to extents when soils don't allow 100%, you can get percentages of that. And I know right now, professionally working with a lot of geotechnical engineers doing soil investigation work, they will come back after analysis is that, you know, it won't perk, let's move another direction. As opposed to, I believe what should be a more reasonable answer, it doesn't perk perfectly, but let's see what we can get out of it and use it as much as possible to keep water on site. Then we'll focus on downstream.
Yeah, definitely.
So that thinking, I think, ought to be promoted more.
Okay, so, yeah, definitely. I think we'll look at adding that. Because definitely yeah. with the Stormwater Design Manual, dispersion and infiltration are the two main things that you're supposed mm-hmm. to look at first. And that is one of the requirements in the new standards is that most every project is going to have a geotech report, whereas they haven't had to have that in the past, but mm-hmm. they're going to have that. So then we'll find out if the soils, if infiltration works. And if the geotech report shows that the soil, that it can infiltrate, the developer is going to have to infiltrate. And that's kind of.
Yeah.
Is that required in homes too?
Mm-hmm. It's anything above 2,000 square feet impervious, right? Yeah.
Yep.
Any project that's going to add 2,000 square feet or more impervious, they're going to have to do a soils report.
Yeah. The. Yeah.
Which is most every house now. So the new ones that are being built, the footprint.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so infiltration will be. Use more. But yeah, we can beef that up in the zoning code. So I'll look at that.
So, John, is that correct? You have a bog? It's a wetland on your property?
That's not what he's saying.
Just trying to understand that.
Court enforcement.
They're taking notes, John.
I'm going to strike that from the record.
Let's see. Not tomorrow.
Okay.
Great. Is that it? Any other questions? All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have no minutes to approve. I guess it looks like there are two city council actions for staff to report on.
Just quickly, if you recall, perhaps we had put forth a revised schedule for the Houghton Everest and 6-week quarter study. Council agreed with that, and that's been deferred now. I mean, we're still working on it, but the deadline has been deferred until early 2017. So, but we are moving forward. Hope you all are following that, and we'll be coming back to you in the near future to give you a status update on where we are. Secondly, October 4th, the City Council will be considering the proposed sign code amendments that you all looked at. I think, Eric, you're planning on being there for that evening?
Yep.
Okay, so that's going forward. And then I have a couple of calendar updates. There's an error that should be October 13th, not October 17th for the Planning Commission. And I think at this point we're probably going to cancel that, but hold that for now until we can get that confirmed. But then again, October 24th, we're having a joint meeting with the both of you again on LID and on the critical area ordinance. And also thinking about November meetings and whether we need November 17th as a substitute. This is for the Planning Commission instead of November 24th. Is the Planning Commission available on the 17th? We're not sure we need that yet, but wanted to see if you are available just in case.
I'm not.
Sandeep, you say you're not?
I'm not.
Okay.
I'm also not.
Okay.
November
that is Thursday, November 17th.
I am.
Wait, in lieu of, isn't the 24th Thanksgiving?
I'm pretty sure I'm good.
So,
I won't be here.
You won't be here? So we might not have a quorum for that, okay. All right, we'll keep you posted on that. And then it looks like for Houghton Community Council, we'll be meeting on November 28th. Does that work? That's your normal that's your normal fourth Monday of the month.
Yeah.
So there normally be meetings.
That's your normal meeting date. It is after Thanksgiving. But. So just want to confirm that's still good. All right?
Yep.
Okay, that's all I have.
I will not be here on the 13th, October 13th. But you said that's probably going to be canceled?
Most likely, yes. Mm-hmm.
Good. Then I won't miss one.
Well, time. Okay. There's nobody left in the audience to give comments tonight, so we're at the end of our agenda. 10:16, this meeting is adjourned.
Thank you all.